Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of the Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Please get the hell out of here. This place gives me the creeps.
Why didn't you tell me to come to it?
Hello, may I help you?
You can sure as hell try. Hi, I'm Abe Froman. Party of three for 12. Is there a problem?
You're Abe Froman.
That's right, I'm Abe Froman.
The sausage king of Chicago.
Yeah. That's me.
Listen, young man. Entre nous, I'm very busy here. Why don't you take the kids and go back to the clubhouse?
Are you suggesting that I'm not who I say I am?
I'm suggesting that you leave before I have to get snooty.
Snooty?
Snotty.
Snotty?
Okay, Abe. Let's go.
No, I'm not going anywhere. No, we'd like to be seated.
Listen, young man, either you take the field trip outside or I'm going to have to call the police.
You're gonna call the police on me?
Yes.
Fine. As a matter of fact, I'll call them myself.
Yes. Call the police. This'll be a hoot. Give me the phone. I have another call.
Huh.
I've had enough of this horsing around. Give me the phone back.
You touch me, I yell rat. There's another phone around here somewhere. Find it.
Wonderful. I weep for the future.
Okay, Ferris, can we just let it go, please?
Ferris, please. Come on, too far. You're gonna get busted.
A, you can never go too far. B, if I'm gonna get busted, it is not gonna be by a guy like that.
Then it is 28, 27. Wait. There we go. 28. Hello there. It is 28 minutes after the hour of 1, and this is the month of March in the year of our Lord, 2011. Thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious. Well, they're a little ostentatious. Not a lot. I mean, it's not showy. It's not in a way that is off-putting or that you'd find unpleasant in any sort of fashion, manner, function, or form. I would say it's just ostentatious enough.
It's fancy-ish.
That's right. I mean, it sort of winks in the direct. It nods in the general vicinity of indulgence.
Yeah, you say, "Ooh, nice." But you don't feel uncomfortable or out of place.
How perfectly appointed and decorated this room is, and we say thank you, and then we try to act like we don't notice, but we do. And this is all true. We are here above the milk packing district in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for drawing near that ye might be amused and entertained on this Thursday. It is Thursday, March 3rd, 2011, and welcome to day 12. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Amusements and Whimsy. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to be part of today's program, it's 503-505-6964. Hey, was it listener Walter that sent you the picture of what's-her-name getting a bunch of pipe from Ron Jeremy?
No, I believe that was Michael in Seaside.
Michael in Seaside. Because then I guess either... Well, I don't know how to explain this, but, it's like on Skype. Well, Skype is like, it's like Yahoo Messenger, where there's avatars. People have their name, and there's... And usually it's just some... It's just some craptastic avatar that the company themselves has defaulted to. Like the ones on Yahoo, are just sort of... they look like something like a terrible, terrible, like a terrible sort of anime kind of a theme, but not done done especially well. Just like all of the standby or the default avatars on the Xbox just look like crap that they found in it, like a dumpster behind the Nintendo Corporation. Like stuff that Nintendo decided not to use because it wasn't quite up to their standards, but that doesn't stop Microsoft, and they just rooted around in the trash, and they just found a bunch of avatars and just stuck them on. So this guy's avatar just appears to be a huge boob. Okay. And an unclothed boob at that. Mm. And so I was wondering if that
You're saying he himself appears to be a huge boob.
Well, I don't know. I haven't really met him. I mean, it's possible. In fact, it's what we've spoken to him. It's Walter in the Netherlands.
Oh, yes.
In Rotterdam.
I remember Walter in the Netherlands.
So he apparently met... Well, this is one of those things where I think I must have left the Skype connection running just like forever last night, because this message came in and said, Rick, what are you doing up at 5:19 a.m.? It's 2:19 here in the Netherlands. And then, like, off to the left is just a big boob. So that's what greeted me when I woke up this morning. There was no point to that story. It's 503-505-6964 if you'd like to join us. 503-505-6964. You can also email us if you like, if that's your pleasure, if that's the means by which you choose to convey your brilliance to us so that we might disseminate it to the masses who are yearning, huddled, even now, gazing heavenward, waiting for your bits of genius to rain onto them like so much raining stuff. It's 503-505-6964 or rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed. It's Don, D-A-W-N, Don. At rickemerson.com. You can also Skype via, using the actual Skype text service if you like. That's the Rick Emerson Show. Is the username there, all one word, Rick Emerson Show, or the text box open on the website as well. By these means, and means not yet discovered, ye may contact us with whatever it is on your brain today.
And we're on the Twitter.
That's true. Also the Facebook.
I am Don Taylor 666 on Twitter, and Rick Emerson is on Twitter. We got the Facebook.
This whole thing is making me tired. Is that a thing that we should be saying more? Like, hey, we're on Twitter at blah, 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 blah.
I just don't know.
The whole thing just exhausts me.
It's one of those things that people seek it out, but you can mention it and they might not think, oh, yeah, Twitter.
But see, like because you mentioned the Charlie Sheen thing the other day, you couldn't search for him. You had to type it in manually.
Right. Well, the thing with Twitter is that you can...
If I type in Don Taylor, just your name, does it come up with you?
There is another. You will get a list. You can find all of the Don Taylors who are on Twitter. There is someone. I'm Don Taylor 666 because some other Don Taylor already had Don Taylor for Twitter. So,
but in
she's
other words,
really boring. But she's wasting the name.
she's just squandering it.
It's infuriating.
Is it? But I mean, if I just type in Don Taylor, will it spit back like a bunch of results of which you are one?
I think, yeah. If you go to Twitter proper, and then I think there's a search thing, and say Don Taylor, say how about these Don Taylors? I would just be one of them.
For example, our friend Lisa Desjardins, she's on the Twitter, and it's like that. And see, and the thing is, when she ends her broadcast, she doesn't give out her email address. She doesn't give out the web address. The only thing she tags her broadcast with is she says, by the way, you can send me a tweet. She says, I'm Lisa D. CNN, or I'm at Lisa D. CNN. So she has apparently decided, or maybe CNN has made the decision for everybody, that Twitter is, that is the primary means by which people should communicate. CNN obviously has some edict that they have passed down, that Twitter should be... That should be the first means of communication. That should be the primary method by which people are conveying messages to you. Maybe because it's sort of a public forum. So I'm just wondering if that's a thing we don't mention enough. And here's the other thing. It's like, have we reached the point where maybe I don't need to give out the email address? I just don't know. Not because of how long I've been on or whatever, but are we reaching the point where people can seek that information out, but you should give out the Twitter address first?
I think it depends on how you want to get information. I think for the purposes of what we do, we probably prefer people to call, Skype, email.
Right.
You know, I mean, a lot of our interaction with people back and forth is them sending us links to news stories, stuff like that. It's more awkward to do that on Facebook or Twitter.
Especially because you have to be watching for it. I guess you could run one of those clients that tells you when you've got a new message or whatever.
Yeah. So, you put in a name in the search function on Twitter. I just put in my name, and then you get up a page of results, and there's a thing that says people search results. Click on that, and then you get all the people. And I am the second Don Taylor listed. The first Don Taylor is Melissa Don Taylor.
She's self-formed Micah.
No, she's a Playboy model.
Oh, well, you said she was boring.
Well, no, she's not the one who is just Don Taylor.
Oh, I see.
I don't actually see Don Taylor. She's not in the... There's It's Taylor Dawn. There's Dawn Taylor, who says she's a wife and mom. There's Dawn Taylor, McDLT777, who just under the description, it just says, just being me. And her name is Dawn Taylor. Uh-huh. So you can find all the Dawn Taylors on Ms. Dawn Baby, who describes herself as a witty girl about town who enjoys good food, good drink, and an even better read.
You know, I saw somebody the other day who actually in their like the profile or whatever for Twitter, they actually described themselves as being sassy, which I didn't think was a thing you could say about yourself. I thought that fell into the giving yourself a nickname category of stuff.
It's like calling yourself a survivor. You just don't say that about yourself.
Other people have to say that about you, or you know, or like a pioneer.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody or is it, you know like a trailblazer, you're breaking. You know, has done groundbreaking research. Other people have to say things like that about you. If you do it yourself, it's just that's a thing that really only like Charlie Sheen and David Lee Roth. You know, can get away with. You know, I just, that's not a thing. But, okay, I don't even know why I'm talking about this, except to say that it's like, if you were to go back and look at this, look at like a pie chart or a graph or something of the 13 years that this show has been on the air, during which I presumably could have been, I don't know, maybe working to cure a disease or something. But the 13 years we've been doing the show, the amount of time we spent at the beginning of every broadcast giving out the contact info has just ballooned all out of proportion. That's the fastest growing segment of that is the fastest growing bit on the Rick Emerson Show is just the 45 minutes at the beginning where I tell you all the goddamned ways you can contact us. Like the phone number, which, you know, is less important, I think, for radio stations and radio broadcasts in general now, period, just because people text or Twitter. That is a thing that I'll be 90 years old and I will always say that as like the first thing out of my mouth when we come back, just because it was like beaten into me by program directors over the years. It's like the thing of saying the call letters or saying the frequency, because you know you realize now with like radio stations, here's a thing to think about. This may not be interesting to anybody else, but for people who are intrigued by radio and how it works to whatever degree, an interesting thing about radio now is for all intents and purposes, if you are a DJ on some radio station, you don't need to say anymore the name of the station. You don't need to, you're listening to Hot 105. You don't need to do any of that. Because the reason you say that a million times, and the reason that, like, the station's name is in the phone number, call 1-800-HOT-JAMS, you know, or whatever, is because then when people will get a diary from Arbitron, which I can now, I realize now that that may be the first time I've ever actually said the word Arbitron during the show, because, if you know, on radio, you're not allowed to say it. Can't reference them at all. They don't exist.
Really?
Somebody calls up, yeah, you can't talk. It's called, it is called diary manipulation. If you discuss the fact that Arbitron even exists, if you mention them, God forbid if you were to tell somebody, I mean, seriously.
That's crazy.
Welcome to the world of terrestrial radio. And it's like rock and roll. They don't screw around. It's a real threat that they wave over you too. Because it's like with the FCC. You know, people would sort of think that I was a tight ass about people swearing on the show when it was like they were holding a $325,000 fine over your head. So it is with Arbitron. If you actually go, it actually gives me little shivers of fear and excitement just to say the word out loud. It's like I'm saying Voldemort. Oh. No, if you were to go on the air and just and say, hey, so everybody out there got one of those Arbitron diaries, be sure to write down you listen to this show. If you were to tell people to do that, they will actually they will do something called delisting you, which means that when the new ratings book comes out, it's not that like your ratings are lower. You just don't get them. You're not listed. You become an unperson. And of course, you are totally effed then. You would be fired almost certainly if you were the jock who caused that to happen, because without the numbers, they can't sell anything to ad agencies. Ad agencies are like, well, what are your ratings? And it's like that's all they care about is the Arbitron numbers.
So you would say your name all the time so that if people were filling out the Arbitron diaries.
So when Arbitron says via their paper diary, they would say, so on Thursdays, we need you to. That's why radio stations do all their big contests on Thursdays, too, is because traditionally Arbitron calls the homes of their diary keepers on Thursdays and said, don't forget to fill out your paper diary. And you go, oh, crap, I guess I gotta. Okay, hey, honey, what do we listen to this week? And of course, when people say, honey, what do we listen to this week? Because we gotta write it down in this archaic paper system. What they do is they just write down the last thing they remember listening to. And if it's a Thursday, you might have listened to some station because they're giving away Corvettes all morning. So that's why the big radio station contests were always on Thursdays. It's weird. This is the thing. I realize now that I've actually never, most of the stuff I probably never, ever, ever talked about. As much as we talk about the business of radio, we probably never talked about a lot of this stuff because you were not allowed to. So yeah, so if you mentioned Arbitron on the air or in some way did something, and other radio stations, of course, being dicks, would report you for it. Stations routinely just run tape on other stations, and if they catch you mentioning Arbitron, they'll call Arbitron and they'll squeal on you. And then Arbitron will just delist you, which means when the new ratings book comes out, where like the Don Taylor show would be, there's just a big blank there.
Wow.
And so the general manager says, well, we can't sell this to McDonald's. You're fired. But anyway, so that's why radio stations all have the name of the station and the phone number and the whatever, so that when you're filling it out, you go, oh yeah, Hot Jams 105. But now, because everything is done with that people meter, which is just a thing you wear on your belt or whatever, and that actually listens to the station, it detects that you are hearing the station, it is now not necessary for the DJ to ever say the name of the station, because you're not writing it down. The radio station is just being registered by this thing he's wearing. So radio stations from now on, they actually could just go forever and never identify themselves except as required by the FCC. It's a strange world.
Hmm.
Jesus.
Speaking of the whole strange world thing, too, the living in the future and things are just weird. When I was getting ready to do my show yesterday over at Cascadia FM, Hamfister Radio, I was sitting in the room with Bobby. We were sitting there setting up the mics, getting our headphones, getting ready to go. Robert Wagner, owner and operator of the station, he was standing over in the kitchen area doing something on his phone. I was talking to Bobby about how I had been listening to the Bee Gees and the whole thing I mentioned yesterday. I remembered all the words to the Bee Gees
song.
How
deep is your love?
How deep is your love? And so Bobby just started singing it a little bit. And so I started singing it. I started singing How Deep Is Your Love. Now, as you'll recall, yesterday we set up our phones to get the tweets when Charlie Sheen tweets.
Right.
So I get alerted to the phone. But I also somehow enabled the thing that whenever anyone mentions me on Twitter, it will send me a message and go, ding.
You know, alert.
So I'm sitting here, I'm singing How Deep Is Your Love. My phone lights up and I see there's a tweet from Robert Wagner talking about how I'm singing the Bee Gees. Then I go, oh, Robert Wagner tweets that I'm singing the Bee Gees. He's standing right across the room and he goes, Jesus Christ, I just entered that.
You're making my brain hurt.
So,
it's so weird.
So it was very freaky to all involved.
Were you the one who was there? Because you and I went to see Colton together, and Patrick and Laura. We all went to, we doubled to go see Jonathan Colton. And then we went with Cheryl. I think it might have been when we went with Cheryl. We're at Colton and it was, and he goes to intermission or whatever, I guess between Paul and Storm and Colton coming out. And, all the nerds immediately take out their phones. And I Twittered something. I got out my phone and I sent this Twitter. I said, intermission at Colton show equals sound of 1,000 miniature lightsaber apps being fired up. Because every guy takes out his phone and goes, whoosh. And I Twittered something about, it's the sound of 1,000 lightsaber apps going on. And so I typed that in and I pressed send. And then it was I have no illusions about me and my place in the universe. I realized this was only a thing that would happen at a Colton show. I hit send, and then all around me I heard this ding, 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 ding. And it was I sent a thing that appeared on the phones of everyone in the seats around me.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And they're all and then immediately the guys are all, I just got your tweet, the show ever. Woo! It was the strangest. I mean, it was when Seamus's brother was in the hallway that time, and Seamus was in Colorado on the phone to his brother.
My brother's outside your door.
He's in the hallway, and the brother is emailing him back, and then Seamus is typing me what he's saying on the screen, and he's outside the door.
You know, we should do when we have our listener party, because we are in talks about putting together a listener party. We do our listener party. We should figure out a way, and I know that one of our tech friends can do this. Figure out a way to get a PowerPoint kind of a thing going up on a screen, and with our Twitter feed, and then have people in the show take pictures of us when we're on stage and stuff, and then we can open up those twit pics on the screen behind us.
Oh, I see. Okay, I get what you're saying. So
we could check, because I know that Eddie Izzard did a show a few months ago where he actually had a thing on a screen behind him that was scrolling and showing all of the Twitter things that people were sending to him. And he said, and so I remember I sent something in because I thought that was very cool to have my tweets to Eddie Izzard on the screen behind him while he was on stage. And we could do something like that, and it would be cool because it's they have people take pictures of us, and then we could show them.
Are you just asking for people to take photos of you like right then so you can then look at them on stage while other people watch you looking at yourself?
I just think the whole meta aspect of it, it's like, I'm at the listener party and I took a picture of the listener party and there's my picture on the stage behind them at the listener party that I just took with my phone while I'm at the listener party.
So it's like a recursive tweet,
yeah,
sort
exactly.
of.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Can I just
say, maybe that's an idea that sounded better inside my own head.
It's just one of those things where, here's the thing, it doesn't, that's a perfectly fine sounding idea and funny and interesting and meta and all of that. Here or like at a Jonathan Coulton show or, you know, really, in most places in America, in any other time in human history or, you know, any other country now, that just sounds like, that is just like America on display right there. Just, you know, everybody send me pictures of me and let's all look at them together. Oh, look, it's me. I'm awesome. I'm huge.
I just think it would be good for us because our audience are so like geeky and tech oriented that I think it's just, I could just see everyone getting a giggle out of it.
I think that this audience would totally, because they would know what that was about. They'd get that. Well, because it's like I asked, there's that listener, Nicholas, who, I have to get back to him about this at some point, but he was one of the, he did the Iron Giant Geeko Lantern, but he's going to do that recursive shirt of me. And it's like, very few people, and I'm probably not one of them, can wear a recursive shirt, you know, that has like just their own face to infinity and not look like a douche.
Yeah.
I mean, it basically is just, it's basically just like Adam Savage and Will Wheaton. So this is why, and I don't think he really got the greatness of what I was, because that's what I said. I wanted a recursive shirt that was like me, then Wheaton, then Adam Savage, then Coulton. And I was trying to explain it. I don't think I conveyed the idea really well. But I don't even know what I'm talking about. Oh, you know, when I saw Green Day, Green Day did a thing like that, though, where they had the live Twittering going on. It wasn't on stage as such. It was on the Jumbotron or, you know, whatever it is, the thing that hangs down in the middle of the whatever for the basketball games. Or, you know, and it was like you could Twitter from the audience, but please play American Idiot or whatever. And it was that way. And of course, like an idiot, I just took out my phone. I guess I got to send something because, you know, because that's what you do. So, no. I think that's a good idea. You should just put that in the hot. Put a pin in that.
Okay.
And then we'll revisit. By the way, This just sums up the entire thing about Arbitron, by the way, for good or bad. I still can't believe how weird it sounds to say that word out loud. By the way, to everybody over the years, I should now give a blanket apology. I should do this as like a separate mini podcast or whatever that we can just send to everyone who has ever listened to any version of my show. Anybody who ever, ever, ever emailed me, which they did all the time because they didn't know. How would they know? And said, hey, I got one of them, their Arbitron diaries. That's awesome. Should I tell them that I listen to you all day? Because it's like you get that, and you just like the good news, bad news. You go, that's great. I can't tell him, you know, to listen. And so what you would say is...
Follow your heart.
You would say, in language carefully vetted by the legal department, you would say, thank you for listening. Sometimes they wouldn't even let you say that. But you would say, thanks for the email. I'm sure that you will report your listening accurately and honestly. Thanks so much. And that was, you know, and you hoped that that was like the wink nudge, because if you just say yes, write us down, because then it's going to be some guy at Clear Channel who is like baiting you to do it, and then he will squeal on you to the man, and then you know. So this guy says, hey, by the way, Rick, I did an Arbitron diary a few years ago. Even though I couldn't listen to you, you were still in my diary.
That's
so
nice.
That's, you know, there you go. There's a thing you can do, final thing about Arbitron Diaries, because, you know, otherwise you have to just start talking about, you know, like wax pencils and stuff. But you can actually, if you want, if you're a radio station, you can go back to North Carolina, I think is where they're based, or New Jersey or someplace. You can go back and you can ask to inspect the diaries. Like, if you believe that maybe the ratings that came out were somehow inaccurate, you can say, like, well, I want to go look at the actual diaries. It's like looking at Obama's birth certificate, like in the vault, not just the one online. You go, well, that's just a picture. I want to see the real thing. So you can go back and you can actually look through the Arbitron diaries that people have filled out, and it's like they were just filled out by primates. I mean... I literally, there was one written in crayon.
Technically they were, you know, filled out by primates.
But I mean, I'm not talking about even advanced. I mean, I'm talking about like the tiny occipital lobe primate.
You're talking about the droopy-limbed children?
That's what I'm saying. And it was like they would just write down like, you know, I listened to the Lars Larson show on KUFO. It's like they had no idea what show was on where, when anything was. I listened to Howard Stern every night. I mean, it would just be crap that made no sense. And from that, Arbitron was supposed to, like... they were basically just Joseph Smithing it. They were just putting all the diaries in a hat and then just going, 12 share, zam, you know? But, of course, like Joseph Smith, they could never do it the same way twice in a row because they're just making it up. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us today. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian is going to be here in the studio with us, talking about life in Portland and Multnomah County. Peanuts Watch coming up today. Top five, really yesterday's top five, which is in fact Tuesday's top five. We'll do that today. It's the top five songs used by me, Rick Emerson, to obtain show mode. Also, clue number four. For the EH Vending Name That Snack contest, brought to you by EH Vending. Find out more at ehvending.com. I will talk about my Leverage audition in just a moment.
Yes.
Don Taylor's tracking the following stories for you on this Thursday.
We have approval in Las Vegas for an amusement park on the Strip. We have a Northwestern University professor who had a live sex act demonstrated in front of his class. And we have Mazda recalling cars due to spiders.
Really?
Yes. Thanks to Cheryl for sending this story, by the way.
Wow. Okay. Recalled because of spiders?
Recalled because of spiders.
Incidentally, somebody says the other Don Taylor's only boring to you because you already have boobs. So.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I guess it's a fair point. Says you guys should
and
do...
they are magnificent.
Well, there's like you. These. Can I just say, here's a little snippiness that came out of you the other day. And if we were not on the air, I would use the my wife and I's preferred term for that, which is
I will not deny that I am occasionally a little bit that word that you were thinking about using. I am occasionally a little snippy.
You're a person who is seen by others on a Tuesday.
Yes.
Yes.
It happens.
But and I found myself using that word again the other day, by the way, off the air, and I realized that not everybody's so immune to that word as I am and as Laura is. That's what it. By the way. Like, reason number 750 why she's the best wife ever, because she swears like a trucker, including the use of the C word constantly, so to speak. When we were talking about the Sheen, and he posted his first twit pic, or what, his very first Twitter post,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, Sheen was some big-boobed girl. And you're like, she's not that big-boobed. And
well,
then you just,
not.
Like, went back to typing.
Well, they weren't.
I'm just saying it's all relative, though. Compared to you, maybe not. Compared to olive oil.
Well, here's the thing, is that I have noticed that... Whenever men notice a shapely pair of breasts, they refer to them as big. And the thing is, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, often these women that you're looking the boobs on are themselves quite petite. And so their breasts themselves are not really that large. They are often just appropriate for their height or size, or large for the fact that they themselves are only like 5'3" and weigh 105 pounds. But they're not big boobs. You look at somebody like this, I think you can look at like Scarlett Johansson and say, yes, she has large breasts for, you know, her size. You know, Jennifer Love Hewitt has large breasts. But, you know, the picture of the chick with Charlie Sheen, those are not big boobs.
See, but I guess I'd have to reserve judgment because...
They're very nice looking boobs. She's an attractive woman. I would not call them big.
I'm not soliciting for porn. I'm really not. But I think I would have to reserve judgment because she's also, I mean, she was just wearing like a tank top or a wife beater or something. So I would also have to see them because, you know, like the Wonder Bra and the padding and the pushing, it can all be very deceptive.
A cleavage alone is not an indicator of big boobs. Cleavage just means that they've been kind of shoved into place.
Also, I don't really have any size. I don't have any sense of what like kind of frame she has. You know, I don't know if she's tall, if she's small. Largely because I don't know anything about Charlie Sheen. Because it's like, you know, Al Pacino's like 3 feet tall. So, I mean, Charlie Sheen could be a midget for all
I believe he's an average size guy, which means he's like 5'7", 5'9". And she's a good head shorter than he is. So she's about, you know, 5'4". So, you know.
Seamus feels it's important to note that the objectification only goes so far. This is a fair point. He says, we don't judge boob size on their own. We judge them in the context of the body they're on. We objectify broads, he says, but not to the point that we remove the woman entirely from the boobs.
See, it's just a matter of I was not denigrating her breasts in any way. You know, if you had said, nice rack. She was a chick with a nice rack. I still would think in my own head that I think rack denotes large breasts. But you still say, nice boobs. But when you say big boobs, if they are not actually big,
it was
then,
just the tone.
You know,
it was a little bit of a dismissive smugness.
There might have, I might have been dismissing it
a little bit. They're not that big. Because that is just like sort of an implied like mine. You know, that's you know compared to me, Don Taylor. That's really what that was. And which again,
I wasn't actually putting myself
seriously
in that equation at all.
You
I was
should
just thinking,
though. If I was you, I'd do that all the time. I'd be like, look at these. Your face. I mean, I would just do that constantly. I would just be like, well, I guess they're okay, but they're not, I mean, look at these.
They're not like these.
And just sort of, you know, come on. I mean, hello. Oh, you know, we missed the snuff watch of Jane Russell dying the other day.
I know. I know.
Such a 12-year-old. Immediately, I just go to... That's the only thing that reminded me. She's been dead for like a week. I didn't remember it until we started talking about
boobs. Oh, yeah, boobs.
Then it all came back. I'm so glad we're getting this done before Anna comes in the room. This is really true. Seamus is totally right about this because men are often accused of being obsessed with sort of, you know, breast size and the chick has got to have totally just out of control breasts. But it really is all about proportion because you take the same whatever and you put it on two different girls and depending on the body size,
right.
You know, it really is contextual. It has to do with the woman herself and the frame upon. And that is where you get the thing of like, well, they're, you know, oh, they're huge. It's when they seem too large for the woman on which they reside. That's the thing. Because like Jennifer Love Hewitt, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, I don't really know that she's got all that much up there.
No, she really does, actually.
Compared to who, though, is the thing. I mean, like, I just don't know. I mean, compared to other women with her body type, probably. I mean, compared to Portia de Rossi, yes. But I mean, compared to your Aretha Franklin, no. But then again, there's a lot of Aretha. So, I mean, it's...
Although Portia de Rossi may be a bad comparison, because Portia de Rossi
like
is probably
Culkin.
Like a foot taller than Jennifer Love Hewitt.
And just seems
so
to be...
she could manage those breasts a lot better than Jennifer Love Hewitt does.
She just seems to be fundamentally curveless, too. I mean, Portia de Rossi is, and she's a very attractive woman. But when guys say that, you know...
Well, she dropped about 20 pounds that she didn't really need to drop between that movie Sirens and Ally McBeal. And those were 20 pounds she should have held because you can see her naked in that movie Sirens, and she was a damn fine looking figure of a woman.
Well, and she had an eating disorder too. She was on.
Well, Ally McBeal. Anybody who works for David E. Kelly ends up with an eating disorder.
It's in the writer.
Yeah.
You get bottled water backstage. We get bulimia.
Yeah.
She was on the Ellen Show recently because she has a book out. She was talking about I think she was a puker. And she was talking about that. You know, here's a little truism. Can I just tell you? Here's a thing that guys wish that women knew. This is, and I know that there are exceptions to this, but I'm just speaking. I speak for, I believe, the majority of men. Maybe not like a super majority, but I think a majority of men. Generally speaking, there is no cute girl that wouldn't look cuter if she like weighed 10 pounds more. And that's a thing that guys know. There's no cute face that wouldn't look better if the chick put on 10 pounds.
And there are some actresses who seem to know that. Because I know there was the, like that movie Sirens, Elle McPherson was in that. And she put on weight because she knew she was going to be naked. And it worked. Dana Delaney in Exit to Eden. She actually gained weight because she knew she was going to be wearing the S&M gear and she wanted to look voluptuous.
And I believe walks out of the water like full frontal nudity at one point in that movie.
There's a movie with Salma Hayek and Colin Farrell that I can't remember the name of now, but it takes place in like the 40s and it came out about 2 years ago. And Salma Hayek actually has a nude scene
the Frida Kahlo movie or whatever.
No, it's not the Frida Kahlo movie. But she's frolicking in the surf with it. But also she had said she had put on, I think, 15 pounds for that part because it takes place in like the 40s. And she wanted to have what she felt was she plays a waitress.
Yeah.
Realistic. And man, the scenes where she is like actually naked. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm going to make a little note to myself here. A little later on.
So, yeah, I admire the actresses who actually go, you know, I think I want to be a little more curvy for this.
Well, that's, I mean, because, like, the other thing is, like, never mind. I was just going to say that my other big example, and however anybody feels about her as an actress, I know that she tends to be not polarizing. There's a lot of people who don't like her. But I will say that when, what's her name, Renee Zellweger got all, she plumped up a little bit for Bridget Jones. I'm telling you right there, there's so much better than just like the bony, pointy, you know. Yeah. Or what's her name, Lisa Edelstein, who plays Cuddy. You know, if you, I mean, she has like, it's like every year she's on that show, she loses more weight. And at some point you're just like humping it like a coat rack.
Well, Renee Zellweger, when she was in Empire Records.
Yeah.
And so that was before she got really skinny and extra squinty, you know. So, yeah, she did look better in Bridget Jones's Diary. She looked normal in Bridget Jones's Diary, which was where the irony was that she was supposed to be playing someone who was actually, you know, a little bit overweight.
Right. And it's like, and you'll hear, I mean, and people who want to be really, like, snippy, often but not always, but usually other women, who will be real snippy about that, about, you know, and it's like bony chicks who are trying to, you know, trying to convince themselves that it's not, you know, sort of creepy looking. And they'll say things, well, you know, but, I mean, you know, really, I mean, what would you, you know, I mean, when it comes to the clothes being off and naked, I mean, who's really going to look better? And the thing is, like, no one looks good naked, really, in the grand, unless you're a model. And weight has nothing to do with it. Almost no one really, really looks good naked because your body's just kind of weird looking regardless. Like, your body's just sort of odd for almost everyone. Speaking of which, final thing, and we ought to get a handle on everything here. And I'll talk about the leverage when we come back, which would be great, because then you and Anna can sort of tag team making fun of me.
And I'll ask you my meat question at some point.
Really?
I can ask the meat question while Anna Griffin's here, because I think she'd have something to say about this as well. No, it's a really interesting question.
I know.
You're just making it sound dirty in your own head.
Yes, I am. By the way, and yes to the like dozens of people who mentioned Jennifer Connelly. She may be the best example of that, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, win an Oscar, and then she suddenly decides to never nude up, which is fine, because now she just looks like Skeletor. So, whatever.
She was so, so beautiful.
Yeah, and you know, I'm fine. You know what? I got, like, I got career opportunities in the hot spot on DVD, so I'm good. Yeah, I'm taken care of on the Jennifer Connelly front, so to speak.
I actually met her before she got all skinny. And then, yeah, because I used to work Renaissance Fair with The Rocketeer, with Billy Campbell, and
the nerdiest thing you have ever said.
But I was actually in a play with him. He groped me. I've been groped
by The Rocketeer,
by Billy Campbell. But anyway, he met Jennifer Connelly on The Rocketeer, and then he brought her to Fair. And she was distinctly uncomfortable all day because, of course, she's like way more famous than he is. And so people kept wanting to, like, touch her and stuff like that. Right. But she is one of the few actresses I've ever met who was just every bit as breathtaking in person as she is on camera. She was just gorgeous.
I have heard people say that.
And very nice, too, if a little bit put off by all of these freaks in their costumes talking to her.
The other person I heard that said about, I think it was Jim Roop, our man in L.A. He was at some award show, and Charlize Theron was there, and he said that Charlize Theron in person, and he said from where he stood, it did not look as though she had slathered on makeup. I mean, she had makeup on, but he said it did not look like it was a deceptive amount of makeup. He said that she was actually so attractive in person that people gasped when she walked by.
I can see that.
People would turn and they would look at her and they would just kind of go, because she would just sort of floated like along the carpet. So
yeah, I can imagine.
All right. I don't even know what I was doing here. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. So, yeah, still ahead today. We got your top five. We got the Penis Watch coming up. Anna Griffin's going to be in the studio with us. We got clue number four in the E.H. Benning Name That Snack contest. And then we'll do some headlines there with John Taylor. So that is all on the way. And so forth. Did you have anything? Oh, you have a meat question.
I do. I have the meat question. I can ask you now.
We should do it on the other side. I can't remember. Why do I keep thinking you saw a movie last night? But I guess the days are kind of drifting together for me this week.
Yeah, no. I saw the movie the night before. We saw Justified.
Oh,
and we have
right.
to talk about Justified
talk about
at some
Justified.
Point.
God, my head hurts. All right. Sorry. Hold on.
It's Justified Day.
Ugh. Was that a reference to something? Were you doing a pun?
That it's Justified Day? No, yeah. I was just saying it's Thursday. On Thursdays we talk about Justified.
You said it while waving your arms around, and I didn't know if there was like a verbal play, like a entendre I was supposed to be picking
up.
No,
I was just flailing.
You're going to find that I'm not that smart today.
Yeah.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. We'll be back after this with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Don't go anywhere. We return momentarily.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
spats. Button shoes. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, author of a thrice-weekly column about life in Portland and Multnomah County. Who I swear to God just said that... well, we should just... Hold on. Where's my... we'll just do this. We'll just
Can I give my Billy Campbell update before we go? Because we had a couple of questions.
Please do.
Someone said, oh my God, whatever happened to Billy Campbell? I don't know what he's been doing lately. He was on a show called The 4400 a couple of years ago that was really good, but it died. He's done some guest starring on some TV shows lately. Interestingly, I got an email from someone saying, is he the son of William Campbell from Star Trek who played Koloth? And I
that
thought,
is interesting, Don.
And I thought, well, and I thought, I know that he was on an he was on Star Trek: The Next Generation, but and then it turns out, no, this whoever this Koloth guy was, his name was William Campbell. He was on the original Star Trek, a character, an actor named William Campbell, no relation. But Billy Campbell, the one I know, he actually had been the second choice to play Riker, and lost out to Jonathan Frakes for Next Generation Star Trek. But he did come back, and he did have a guest. He guest starred a second season episode titled The Outrageous Okona.
Do you ever just hear yourself talking sometimes, and you just sort of get a... all right, I'll just...
Kiny, a slang term for great use in the television series Firefly and the movie Serenity.
Awesome. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program from the Oregonian, where she's the author of a thrice-weekly column about life in Portland and Multnomah County, Anna Griffin. Hello, how are you today?
Did you know that Netflix is getting...
Oh, sorry, let me adjust your mic. I'm sorry.
Also, while you're doing that, in 2000, Billy Campbell was named one of the world's 50 most beautiful people by People magazine, which means I have been groped by one of the world's most beautiful people.
Well, we haven't gotten to the actual groping yet. We'll have to get to that faster, the story here in a second. I'm sorry, Anna Griffin, your microphone was ill-adjusted. That's my fault. Did I know that Netflix what?
Will soon have all the Star Trek series streaming.
Really?
Ooh.
I'm never leaving the house again.
Here's the thing. See, it is just, this is really just... It's what Art Bell once referred to as the quickening, the fact that, you know, that the things, especially technology, evolves at an exponential rate, and that what exists 2 years from now is like actually 15 years ahead, you know, in terms of developmental, you know, flexibility and the ability to have things just, you know, instantly and for information to travel the globe in a nanosecond, whatever. And so it is with Netflix. I mean, honestly, it was like maybe 6 years ago that I first heard of Netflix in the first place. And I was like, it's amazing. They'll send it to you, and in just 3 days. And that's when you realize you've just become one of those dicks that's in Almost Famous talking about the Mojo Wire and how you can send paper over the phone in an hour. Because now, have you noticed this? That you'll just get, and I know you have, you'll just get on Netflix, you go, well, it's not streaming. It's like it doesn't even exist. It's like if it doesn't stream, what's the point of them even having it? Like, why would they even show it to you?
I have to wait for you to mail me the damn thing? Well, I don't have time for that.
You know, and all of that ignores the fact that you could go across the goddamn street to Blockbuster. It's right there. But it's like not only can you not wait a day, you actually can't leave your home. You can't leave the sofa long enough to find it. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody. It's just strange how our expectations, you know, lower and raise at the same time, you know, depending on what we're talking about.
It's like going to a buffet, though, Netflix, because you pay one price. You can just gorge yourself.
See, that
I'm getting my money's worth on Netflix. I know that.
People who were like, I don't know, why do I care about net neutrality? You care about net neutrality because you don't want Comcast to F you out of your ability to stream like 100 things at a time over the internet, yes, which they almost certainly would.
If I want to rewatch every season of Lost once a month, that is my God-given right as an American. Thank you.
Is that a thing you're likely to do?
For my $14 a month, that's what I expect. Yes.
Really?
Why not?
Well, I know.
I can.
I'm not Pat. Spoken like a true American.
Oh, I was sitting at home the other day, and I was looking, just flipping through what they've got on Netflix, and I exclaimed to my husband, with no sense of irony, mind you, I said, oh, my God, they've got the Mighty ISIS.
Awesome. I've actually gotten, I'm so bad about this, and the only reason that I don't feel even worse about myself, the only reason I don't have more self-loathing than I already do, is because by dint of just us being who we are and having the friends we do and the audience and the social circles, there's always somebody, there's some poor bastard you can point to who's worse off. But I noted that I have the Netflix app for my iPhone, and so I used to, like, read and think things and look out the window and just be sometimes. But I will be, you know, I have a home office, and I will be typing away in the home office. And I will just, and I always stay up much later than my wife does because I'm sort of nocturnal. And it'll be like 2 a.m. and I'll be like, I guess I could go for some toast. But the toast, the thing that makes the toast is way over there. The laptop is here. And the thing, I could carry the laptop with me so that I don't have to, you know, so I don't have to go a moment without staring at a glowing screen of some kind, because that's what my day consists of now. But if I do that, then it's like I'd have to unplug it from, like, the 9-terabyte hard drive, which is busy backing up, like, all of the episodes of The Great Space Coaster or some nonsense. So instead, I literally will just go to my iPhone, go to Netflix, take the time to log in, find, like, anything that is just streaming. It doesn't matter, as long as it's there. And then just so I can have some sort of, you know, happening in the background while I'm making toast.
I went to pick up Patrick at work. I think it was night before last. And I was saying I had to wait, sit in the car and wait for him for all of like 10 or 15 minutes. And then not only did I start watching RoboCop on Netflix on my phone, I actually paused it so I could go and tweet and tell people like on Facebook and on Twitter, I'm in my car watching RoboCop on my phone.
That's the next app is going to be the app that I can announce to everyone in the world. I'm sitting on the 9 bus watching Xena on the Steel Bridge.
And then there's another one that just where you can – it's a macro that just tweets, I'm going to kill myself now. I don't know that I mentioned this to you. I think I told you about this, Don, that it's an app, one of those things I downloaded because it was free and it was, you know, it seemed kind of interesting. I probably won't use it, but it's a thing called Into Now. And it's like the Shazam app, which identifies music, but it does television. And you hold it up to the TV, like if you catch the tail end of a show, or if you go like, I don't know, is this a miniseries or is it a new show, an old show? You hold it up to the TV, it detects the audio, and then it tells you the series, the episode, you know, where it falls in the chronology. It links you to other users who watch that show, what else they recommend and what else they're watching, a message board for the show, and then at the bottom, a button that takes you to the IMDb entry and a button that, yes, takes you to the Netflix entry for that show. And it's, like, free, and it just sits there on your phone. You know, and it's a thing. You just find yourself just using it because, you know, it's there, and you want to sort of – but then what you start – here's the thing about those apps is what you start using, like, ironically, then you just use – like, in point of fact. Like, the thing you use just to make a joke about, look how lazy I am, becomes a thing where later you're just sitting in your own sick on the couch, not moving, you know? And it's, like, just spongy and horrible and just, you know, I can't stand any. My muscles are all atrophied. You're just like that. You're like that huge demon in the third season of Buffy that, like, fills the whole hot tub. The huge, like, Grossberger-looking guy, whatever his name was, that has the slaves ladling things on him. Do we all know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
We will not acknowledge it, but yes, we do.
Okay.
Yes.
Could probably find it on. All right.
You can show it to us on your phone.
We'll be right back. I'll be watching something different on Netflix.
Everyone quit talking. Okay. Maybe no one will notice that we were just having that conversation. Hello, Anna Griffin. How are you?
I'm good. It's always nice to come and feel so at home here. I just walk in the door and it's
Now, see, but your whole family must be like that. I mean, you must be surrounded. Your social circle, everybody, you must be surrounded by pop culture nerds. I mean, because we sort of attract our own, right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it's not like I can't imagine that you go along like more than an hour in your life without having some sort of a pop, like a screaming argument about Knight Rider or something with somebody.
I am the bigger geek in my household, but the beauty of children is you can raise them to be just as geeky as you are.
Really?
So yeah, you can train them early.
Is that a thing? You mentioned that your son watched Star Wars for the first time, or I think it was, or he was working up to watching Indiana Jones.
Yes, 8th birthday. It's coming up. It's very exciting.
Are you? And you're excited for him?
Well, I don't let him listen, Rick Emerson, but on its way toward our house is the almost 4,000-piece Lego Death Star that he has wanted forever.
That he has wanted?
Wow.
Or that you have wanted?
Really, that he has wanted. Although I will say it comes with 24 mini figurines, and I'm wondering how many of those he'll miss when I take them from my desk.
Wow. Best mom ever, really. You were not here, I don't think, that the day – we do this segment on the show sometimes called Pop Culture Authority, which is where people will ask us questions about something that they have always wondered or that has puzzled them about pop culture. One of the early ones was, why is the hole in the middle of a 45 record larger than the hole on a 30? And there was this whole answer, which actually ended up being kind of interesting. But I actually had a question at one point. One of the questions came from me, and I said, like, what is that thing in the garbage compactor on the Death Star? Like, what is that creature? And so Dawn said, you know what? I'll find out, and we'll do it as tomorrow's Pop Culture Authority. And so she, you know, writes this explanation about what the creature is. And, of course, like everything in the Star Wars universe, it has, like, it probably has its own spin-off series of novels.
Probably.
Like its own EU version of, you know, comic books at this point. But she brought in this whole explanation about what the creature was and where it exists in the Star Wars universe. And then I don't know why I didn't notice it, but then with a flourish over by the Jack-o'-lantern, and then she just kind of goes, and she pulls this cloak off of something. And I thought you'd become a falconer or whatever. But her friend Robert had given her to bring into the studio his vintage Kenner Death Star.
The best toy ever. The operating trash compactor.
Yes. And the creature and the little foam trash and everything. I mean, it was just, I was so, never before have I been so excited about yet afraid to touch something. I mean, it doesn't, you know, you could bring the Hope Diamond here and I would just be like, it'd be fine. But that thing, like, I didn't want to breathe on it. I was afraid to look at it for too long. I mean, God forbid. I mean, it's like, that's why you'll note that I didn't offer to help you carry it to your car. Because it's like, if I trip and break, that I have to move to Argentina.
I mean, I shoved just the trash compactor part over there thinking you would want to, like, play with the trash. And that's really hardy. It's just a box with a crank.
And it's got, it's like a piece of foam on the side of it, right?
And you, like, were like, oh, and you kind of didn't want to touch it. I'm like, seriously, that part's not going to fall apart.
It just filled me with fear. But it was glorious. I mean, it was and here's the thing. That stuff's so... Here's the thing about Star Wars toys is that so rarely does the thing you remember measure up to the way you remember it. But Star Wars toys, and I don't think this is just nostalgia because a lot of stuff in my childhood is crap. But a lot of those Star Wars toys, now you look back, they're still really great. I mean, they were at the time even, they must have literally seemed like they were from the future because they were so far ahead of everything
else. That Death Star playset, first of all, it's enormous.
Yeah.
It's like, it was on the table, it was like this tall. It's four stories. There's a working elevator. It has all of the figures had little holes in the bottom of their feet, and there's a little knob next to all of the things where you can actually have them standing at the controls doing the things they're doing. It had a gun turret up at the top. It was amazing.
I just have such vivid recollections because I was, I was five when Star Wars came out. So I was the perfect age to go and want the collectibles. And I have such vivid memories of my parents, my divorced parents, so they were competing for my affection, taking me to Kmart and letting me buy the figures one by one and assembling the collection and the way R2-D2's head would click because there
click,
was
click,
a spring
click,
inside
click. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And the wheels, the way the wheels would pop up on the land speeder, and it just... Awesome.
We were talking about I can still remember the way the little felty robe on Yoda and he had the orange snake that went around his and the way that, like, the end of the lightsaber would go all bendy because it was like, it was not very sturdy, and so you'd slide it out. Can I just tell you this?
That was the cool thing too. Bobby showed me that when he loaned me the set, showing me, like, the little guys and the figures and showing me the Luke's armor, how it has, that it would slide up out of his hand like it was going, like he was actually turning it on.
I have to tell you, the single, and this is a bold statement, but I stand by this, I think, the single best tattoo I have ever seen in my life is, and I can't even, and the embarrassing thing is, I know so many guys who are covered in Star Wars tattoos, I can't remember which guy this is. But I saw a guy one time who on the underside of his right arm had a tattoo as though he were a Kenner Star Wars figure, and the little sliding thing for the lightsaber was actually on his arm. And it's like, who would even think to do that, and much less have some sort of confidence that it would look as badass as you want it to? Because immediately, like, he was like in a bar or something. He's like, somebody's like, hey, Ted, show him your tattoo. And he's like, fine. So he rolls up his shirt sleeve, and it was like a room full of dudes who all immediately went, because we all knew exactly what it was. And it was like awesome. It was the best thing we'd seen that week. So
how do we feel about Star Wars coming back in 3D?
Well, I mean, I have assumed that it was inevitable that it would. Do we know that it is?
Apparently, yeah, because I work so hard at my job, I noticed today on the internet that that they're coming out with Phantom Menace first next February.
My thing is, and I will also say that I am not even that hardcore of a Star Wars fan, relatively speaking. I mean, more than the average person probably, but in the realms of, like, nerddom, like, I'm not as freakish about it as I can sort of divorce myself from it a lot more than largely because I didn't, as I've mentioned before, I didn't have the experience of seeing them on the big screen when I was a kid. I had to watch them on this weird shaky bootleg thing across the street, and they all, like, Singaporean subtitles or whatever. But I think for me, it's like, I think a lot of people reached a point with Lucas where they just emotionally distanced themselves from it a little bit, and you just kind of tucked it away in a steamer trunk in your head, and whatever he does from now on, you're just going to sort of, like, maybe acknowledge it, you know, and register it, but not really care about it a lot, because if you care about it, then it's going to allow him to come in and just dilute down the memories of the stuff, you know, that already existed. So I'm kind of indifferent, because I think a lot of people have by necessity become indifferent about Star Wars?
It's going to make it. I think I've told you in the past that my son, I do not acknowledge the more recent of the three movies in my house. It's like family policy. We just don't acknowledge that they exist. And so my son, I have told him, when you are 18 and you live elsewhere, you can see those movies if you want to. But
not in my home.
Right. So it's going to make it very hard if they're in the theater.
Well, and plus you can have a whole generation of kids who, are probably watching those movies really not in the order they're meant to be watched, because they're going to do. See, here's the thing they're going to do with the freaking Chronicles of Narnia, where once Lewis was dead, they just decided, well, let's just rearrange things. And so that's why when you read the Chronicles of Narnia, I mean, it's like I forget it was for Laura and I bought the Chronicles of Narnia for somebody. It was like a friend of ours, their kid was having a birthday or whatever. And they, you know, something about, you know, they wanted books and they didn't have the Chronicles of Narnia and they were the right age. And I'm like, that's awesome. We'll get them the Chronicles of Narnia. And I was I had that like apoplectic rage. Just like that only, you know, that only is triggered by things like that where we're walking around. And she finally just like, I think she actually grabbed me by the arm and just sort of guided me to the car, because I was just becoming angrier and angrier that I could not find a set of the Chronicles of Narnia that had not been renumbered to put The Magician's Nephew, which is the sixth book, first. Because the thing is, The Magician's Nephew is a prequel. But of course, you know, your feeble brain can't possibly fathom the idea that the origin story comes. It is because it's. Here's the thing. The thing about it is that the Chronicles of Narnia is seven. I swear to God, I'll keep this as brief as possible. But now it's like the train has left the station. It's just got to get to the end. It's a seven-volume series about how Narnia was created and destroyed and then created again at the end, and Aslan took everyone to, and it's a Christ allegory and whatever, but it's a seven-volume story. But the seventh book is called The Last Battle, and it is, as the name implies, it is the final showdown between good and evil, and it results in Aslan taking, you know, the Chosen to basically to heaven, etc. But it's a great dramatic device, the way that Lewis wrote it, because you have books 1 through 5, which are, you know, all chronological, and they build up. And then, at the end of book 5, they're like, the battle is nigh. The battle is nearly here. And he does a great tension-building device of the entire sixth book is actually takes place before everything else. He said, but first, let me show you how Narnia was created and how Aslan gave the gift of speech to the animals. And so it's a great little stop down, because it's interesting, but also then it's a little pause, you know, while you figure out how the Duke boys are going to get out of this one. And then you come back and then there's but now they just can't, you know, they figure the kids are just so dense that they won't be able to figure out that it's a dramatic pause. And they went through like every letter that Lewis ever sent, because he saved all of his correspondence. And they found like this one passage somewhere in some letter where he made some passing observation about, you know, like, well, you know, who knows? You know, if I had it to do again, you know, I might write him in a different order, you know, whatever. But the thing is, he didn't write them in that order. No. He wrote them in the order that they were traditionally put. And so
you have to start with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
You have to. I mean, well, and again, because that's the order in which he wrote them. So they're like the Harry Potter books in some ways, in that, you know, every Harry Potter book expands on the one before it in terms of tone, in terms of violence. They're longer. And that is clearly how Lewis wanted it. And, if creators want to meddle with their own work and just distort it beyond the point of recognition or recognizability, then I guess
that's... George Lucas.
Yeah, then that's their right. But this isn't even Lewis... This isn't even like Lewis doing it. Lewis is dead and his family's doing it afterward. And so we went to, I think, 4 different bookstores before I found a used box set of that I would allow her to buy.
This goes so far to explaining why the first time you were at my house and you were looking at the books on my bookshelf and you actually looked at my paperback collection of the Chronicles of Narnia and you said, good for you. You have the right one.
Well.
And I was like, yeah, okay. And then I didn't even ask why. I just moved on to something else.
There are certain benchmarks by which I judge people. There's no getting around that. We've all done that where you go to somebody's house and you look at their, you know, and it's like nothing but rows of Jacqueline Suzanne. And you just go like, no.
Well, aren't there sort of books that when you walk into a bookstore or albums when you walk into a record store, you look for them just – and that is your gauge of the quality of your shopping experience?
Absolutely. And you almost want to buy them again. I mean, where there are books I love so much that you almost develop like some weird OCD thing of wanting to purchase it again just because you love the book. And it's like, do they have a lot? Are they used? Are they new? Are they all with the movie cover or are they with the actual cover? And that is a benchmark by which I judge.
Will you buy the movie cover version?
I have become much more relaxed about that. I used to be really, really hardcore about, I would refuse.
I mean, I would like wait weeks to read a book if I had to wait on the library, the bookstore to get the one. But I think that I am no longer that worried about it for the same reason that I no longer feel the need to defend my music taste to people. That I've kind of gotten to the age where I'm like, you know, whatever, get bent if you don't like it.
So you've either become an adult or you've just given up completely.
I think I've learned to separate like the cover from the book and to realize that it is not the book's fault that it was saddled with a bad cover. You know what
it's
I mean?
It's not the book's fault that Leonardo DiCaprio's on the cover.
Well, that's what you know. Right. Well, a perfect example. Like at my copy of Fight Club is the one that has Norton and Pitt on the cover, which like I'm not crazy about. I mean, I guess it'd be nice if I had one that had the original, but you know, whatever. To me, I think I've learned to not because in the end it was just screwing me because it's like I just didn't have because what you care about is presumably inside. Yeah. So I felt like I was in a strange way. Now we just like we're so up our own ass with this, but we've turned into like some sort of NPR parody here. But I realized that I was judging the book itself, and the
cover.
Content, and literally by its cover, and then denying myself. You know, the actual art or, you know, entertainment contained within.
You know, it's interesting, and I hadn't thought of it until now, but you don't see Harry Potter's with the kids from the movie on the cover.
She won't allow it.
That's fantastic.
It's in her contract.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. Tried to mouthful of ice there. But yeah, and I don't know if it was from the very beginning. It doesn't seem like it could have been because she wouldn't have been that powerful. Maybe they just didn't care until it was already a huge hit, and by then she may have negotiated that. But I do believe it is in her kind of scholastic. They cannot put the film cover on it. It's got to be.
Which is the way it should be because it drives me crazy. You know, as a parent, it drives me crazy when my kids see the movie before the book first. And then it drives me crazy when the book has – I mean, the whole point of the book is you need to use your imagination
right.
a little bit. You need
right.
to let the author's cues guide you, figure out in your own head what they look like. And I think Daniel Radcliffe is very cute, but that's not what Harry Potter looks like for me.
Well, and if the author includes their own illustrations, then I'll also then like that is their choice as, you know, that is their choice as author. For example, Roald Dahl books have fantastic illustrations.
Yeah.
Now they have, on occasion, they have put again terrible covers on his books, not necessarily even from a film, but just, you know, where it's a very contemporary look on the kids in the, you know, and I can sort of get by that because I realize that, like, you got to get somebody to pick the book up off the shelf before they'll buy it. I mean, you got to, like, advertise it. But inside, that should remain sacrosanct.
I do not want my child to think that Willy Wonka looks like Johnny Depp.
Right.
No.
Well, that is, you know, and that's the I was just going to go on this whole thing about James and the Giant Peach. Do you realize this? So in that Henry Selick, James and the Giant Peach, you know, they make the most inexplicable change in that movie where – I was actually just talking about it again. My wife hadn't seen it, and she was watching it with this 5-year-old that she babysits sometimes, and she had him watching James and the Giant Peach. And I was all on my big tear about the mechanical sharks and about how angry that makes me. Because, I mean, it's like you've got a film in which there's a peach the size of, like, the moon, and there's a talking spider and a talking grasshopper and, like, a singing centipede. And yet the idea that when it rests in the ocean, there would be sharks biting it is just unacceptable. So they have to be robot monster sharks. They have to be like literally clanking like riveted sharks because there's just not enough, the fancifulness taking place. But in that book, the thing about it is that James's parents are killed on the first literally the first paragraph. Mm-hmm. They are eaten by a runaway rhinoceros at the zoo. The movie actually preserves that. In the movie, they start the movie by saying, this is James Henry Trotter. He's 4 years old. Here are his parents being eaten by a rhinoceros at the zoo. Bam, dead parents. And yet later on, when the peach leaves the house, they omit the section where the peach rolls over and crushes Auntie Sponge and Auntie Spiker, which is the strangest omission to me, especially because like all Roald Dahl adults, they have it coming. So it's bizarre that they cut that out and that they left in his parents being killed on the first page. Mm. I mean, not that I'm offended. I just don't make any sense. That's like some of that ratings board stuff that just is like makes no sense to me at all. It seems very, very arbitrary. Hello there. All right. Before we do anything else, because if we start something, we'll never get back to this. Okay. What is coming up in the Oregonian, Anna Griffin?
I'm sure we'll have more on Charlie Sheen in Libya.
They should send Charlie
He's
Sheen
in
to Libya.
Libya. Oh my God, he's in Libya.
Oh my God, don't you think he should be our ambassador to rogue nations?
Oh yeah.
Like, if somebody just, like, is being a real pain in the ass, we just go like, okay, look, you forced our hand. And then we just drop in Sheen. You know, we just parachute him right in. Right on, you know, the steps of, you know, like, the Capitol, the Parliament House or whatever. And he just, you know, and he goes in and he just cleans house. As I think only Charlie Sheen really can at this point. You know what?
Really, it's not even the matter of cleaning house. It's a matter of if we don't like what some of these little, you know, tin pot dictator guys are doing, if they're threatening genocide, what have you, we say, okay, You are now, whenever you want to deal with the United States, unless you clean up, you're going to have to deal with Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen has become
he's our ambassador to your country now, and he's the guy you got to talk to.
He's basically our new Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
I was going to say he's our new Chuck Norris.
And they'll finally go, okay, no, we do whatever you want. No more Charlie Sheen.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, if you get some of these, you know, again, these countries where, you know, not everybody has a television, not everybody has the DirecTV. Look, let's be honest. There are probably big swaths of this world that are people causing trouble. They might not at any given moment know what the president looks like, you know, from year to year. If they haven't seen it on CNN, you know, they might not know the prime minister of, you know, what the prime minister of Russia looks like. So,
or maybe they get reruns of the West Wing and they'll be confused.
Totally. And so we just say, like, look, here's our president. He's going to give you a little personal message. And then you just give the, you know, you give the floor over to Sheen and just let Charlie Sheen just sort of be the president as far as they know.
Yeah.
Because if you thought that guy was in charge of the world's largest nuclear arsenal, I think you'd be willing to come to the negotiating table with good faith. That's just my read on things. We asked you a question, then we just completely just – we did that thing that I said we weren't going to do.
I was just disregarding. I was just trying to think of a clever comment to make about porn stars as diplomats, but it just didn't work for me.
We spent like half an hour talking about Dawn's breasts earlier, so really I think that that's been
–
check that off the list.
Actresses'
wow.
breasts.
In general. Sorry, bosoms in general.
You just – you dragged my breasts into it, so to speak, at the very end. But really, we were talking about bosoms in general and on actresses.
It's true.
It's not
yes.
really about me.
No, but all roads lead to you, Dawn, and in this case, to your to your bosoms,
which were groped by Billy Campbell.
Okay,
the
so
Rocketeer.
But I don't think you actually ever said how that happened. So how did the groping happen?
It's very simple. I worked at the Renaissance Fair with him. Billy did enjoy the partying aspect of the Renaissance Fair experience. I don't know anything about his personal life outside of it, but when he was in fair mode, he liked his booze. And he liked the ladies. And my God, he was pretty. I mean, again, one of People Magazine's 50 most beautiful people. He, you know, and he was running around. He was playing Petruchio and Take Me to the Shrew, and he was wearing his tights, and he's like 6'2", and he's gorgeous. And so basically all of us would go, hey, Bill. And he'd come over and go, hey. And he'd like put an arm around you and give you a big smooch and stick his hand down your bodice. And I was one of
wow.
I was one of hundreds of ladies that I'm sure he did that to. But yes, he was. He liked the ladies. He liked his beer. He liked working fair.
Just another notch on the scabbard.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I'm not saying that. I will admit, I was not unique in being groped by Billy Campbell. Let me just say, but it did happen.
But I mean, really, I mean, you know, there's 6 billion people on Earth. I mean, there's probably half of 1% of people who can say that that's happened to them, and yeah. you are one of them.
Yeah.
All right. And really, just – and I let me just say this, and I don't mean this to sound creepy, you know, you've shown me pictures of your Ren Faire outfits from that era. And
seriously, look how pretty he was. I mean, come on.
I'd let him
grope
me.
Who wouldn't be groped by that?
No. I mean if he was here and just offered it up, I'd probably take it. I mean,
yeah.
Why not? We did that thing again. I'm sorry. Hello, Anna Griffin for the Oregonian.
I don't find this uncomfortable in the least bit.
Do people of the Oregonian ask you, like, so what is it you do on that there Rick Emerson show? And you got to talk about the news with the utmost seriousness. I mean, do they even, you know?
Someone, as I was leaving today, someone said, "So what? What's Rick Emerson?"
What's Rick Emerson? He's a fungus. Something you find under the fridge. Let's stop for a moment and there we go. So we'll just work backward here.
Sure.
So as we were just you came in during the last break and we were talking. I said, you know,
I came in when you were talking about Dawn's bosom. Yes,
that's right. And it's just been – this week has just been off the charts like hectic for me. Not a bad week because it's just very, very, very busy. I've had like – it just seems like I've had very little downtime to actually read the news or to catch up on stuff. And usually I'm the guy who's, you know, like, oh, you haven't heard about whatever. But I haven't had a chance to read your column this week. So I know that – is it coming up or is it out now, this piece about house concerts, house parties?
That'll be in tomorrow's Oregonian.
And this is about house concerts.
This is about concerts. This is about city regulators say they are seeing, thanks to the poor economy and all the young hipsters who like their music, a rise in the number of house concerts, house parties, which are lots of fun apparently and pretty much illegal when you do it in residential neighborhoods. And so I'm writing about a particular house in Northeast Portland that has advertised itself online as the substation.
What constitutes a house party? Is it where people are paying?
I think some of it is, are they paying? Is there a band? Is the music? You know, in the city of Portland, if you are in a residential neighborhood, after 10 p.m., you are not allowed to make noise that is audible in any neighboring houses.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And so So concerts that run past 10 o'clock are kind of a no-no.
So if you are – so live music is one thing, but live music after – which I guess makes sense because that's rather than trying to do like a decibel limit or whatever, it's like if you can hear it at the guy's house next door, like you can't do it.
Yeah. And even – I mean there are certain decibel levels that if you're doing them in your house during the day, you're probably going to get in trouble. But in this case, we're talking about places that are either charging admission, charging for alcohol and making a lot more noise than the law really allows, or common sense, or common courtesy.
So the noise element notwithstanding, is it illegal just in general to throw, like even if the noise, even if it was silent, is it illegal to have a party in your house where you're charging for booze or charging for admission?
Yeah.
Really? So that, I guess that makes sense because then you're into like a business. You're not zoned
right.
For...
Right. You can't run a business out of your house without the proper permit. You can't sell alcohol without a state license. And so doing it in your house is... Bad.
Is that a thing they're just deciding to crack down on because there's a lot more of them? Or is it like a revenue generating thing from the state that they want to fine people?
Well, the problem they have is they don't have enough employees to actually crack down on it. So what they're telling neighbors who call to complain is basically, yeah, you should build a case. You guys should document that and then come back to us when you can.
Let
prove
us know.
It.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because those have been. I mean, that's part of the. Rick Emerson's not advocating underage shenanigans, but that is a quintessential part of the American experience in certain places. And I think you go through high school, and it's like the farther along you are in high school, there's always a guy on a Friday telling you about some place where they're drinking like something out of a trash can, because it's a good time for everybody or whatever.
Well, and they're talking. I think the complaints are mostly about really large, huge, raucous ones. But, I hosted a couple of house parties of my own when I owned a house in North Portland. A friend who's a musician and she travels around the country. And when she can't get a venue in town or if somebody has a large enough house, host the thing. And it's like, yeah, it was a did not charge admission, but there was a recommended donation to the musicians.
Right.
They sold folks a couple of their T-shirts and their CDs. It was a small event and there were only like maybe 30 people there. But again, it was not, you think about it, it's not exactly, I think, a strictly illegal venture.
And there's a big difference, I think most of us would agree, that between you do it once a year, you do it a couple times a year, and you're doing it once or twice a month.
As a revenue generator of your own.
Exactly.
Well, it's like there's that whole couple years ago, the thing about the poker, venues, and guys were running like nightly poker games, and really like with a lot of money at stake sometimes, like in their garage, and there was a whole sort of a crash course that a lot of people I think felt like they had to take, and what was illegal and what wasn't, because it was like, is it illegal if the house is taking a cut? Is it illegal if you're doing it more than three nights a week, or if there's whatever? And it's just it's like the whole thing of it. Did they ever fix the thing about the homebrewed beer? When there's some Multnomah County thing that we just – like earlier this year or I guess later last year, but there was some regulation where they suddenly realized it was like illegal to brew your own beer.
No, it's not
or something.
Illegal to brew your own beer. It's illegal to give it to anyone else. It's illegal to drink it anywhere except for in your home.
Not even to sell. It was illegal to give
to just
to
remove
else.
It from the premises and even take it over to somebody else's house,
yeah.
Much less enter it in – and then so they were going, but this means we can't enter it in home brew competitions.
And I think the state actually fixed that.
Did they
recently?
I think they, to their credit, they said, well, that's not right. They were going to,
Yeah. And here's the thing. I mean, most situations like that, if you talk to regulators or the people enforce the law, what they will tell you privately is, as long as you're not a complete jackass,
right.
It's not an issue. The cops are, if I'm making a lot of noise and I have a bunch of people over and the cops will come by. But if I've gone to my neighbors beforehand and said, hey, I'm having a party. We're having our wild Hanukkah party. We're going to be spinning dreidels and singing the dreidel song very loudly. My neighbors will forgive me once a year. It's more the.
And as long as you haven't, done something else during the year that she never, she never brought the lawnmower back, and that's, they're gonna if your neighbors don't have any reason to be holding a grudge against you, and if you're not, as you said, just like a jackass.
And my neighbors
about
it. Do hold a grudge, so.
Well, I tried to never ever talk to my neighbors at all. I like to at the very like my whole thing is just to be a blank, because
he was a quiet man. Now, so we're a little surprised.
That's the thing. It's like because there's just no in my neighborhood. There's no good outcome if the neighbors get to know you too well. It's like they're either gonna know me well enough that they're gonna figure out what I have that's valuable that they might like to steal, or they're gonna be like my Gladys Kravitz neighbor across the street who just will just wait there like, you know, she waits there like Charlie in the Undergrowth, you know, to ambush you. And then she'll talk to you for like 79 minutes about a pain in one of her toes, you know, that the doctor just, you know, and that, you know, and you know, and like, and youths and hooligans on her lawn that are making a lot of noise. So I try to just sort of be whatever. Tied into the house party and the whole high school thing, you mentioned something that I hadn't really heard of because I'm not a kid and don't have kids, about is it Marshall and their prom?
I did a piece in Wednesday's Oregonian, which I know everybody read because everyone reads the Oregonian every day. And if not, I can get you a good deal on a subscription. About Marshall High School is closing at the end of the year. The Portland Public School Board voted.
Are they going to merge it with something else?
Marshall right now has three mini campuses. Mm-hmm. And as part of the high school redesign process, the school board voted last fall to kill Marshall and move those kids elsewhere and use the space for smaller programs. And so you have a bunch of juniors and seniors in particular who are very upset and very sad and kind of missing out on the fun of being big men and women on campus. And so staff over at Marshall are working very hard to give them a prom that's memorable. And this is a very vulnerable population. A lot of these kids are very poor. It's in outer southeast Portland. And so staff is having to essentially beg the public for help, buying tickets, providing formal wear. They're looking for people with any kind of expertise in hairstyling and makeup to go the day of the prom and help kids get ready.
Seriously, somebody needs to be writing this into it. Like, get that what's-his-name, that Finding Forrester guy. Just to... What is it? Mike Rich? Mike Rich, I've got a new treatment for you. You know, and then at the end, it's like the music swells.
Exactly.
And then, like, you know, and then, yeah, and then something by John Mayer plays and everybody sways back and forth and, you know, end.
And the slow clap.
Yeah,
happens.
Exactly. Somebody makes a tearful, heartfelt speech to somebody else. And then the
previously cynical guy who wanted to see the high school close is standing off to the side. He just goes, and then everyone just starts clapping. Yay! Hooray! And the music pulls. Then Hans Zimmer pulls our heartstrings with his
tubas.
What
I love about a piece like that is inevitably I write it, and there's been a lot of very nice response from people who want to buy tickets, and I've had a couple people drop off their prom dresses at my office, so my desk is a little weird right now.
That's a strange phrase.
But then they're also inevitably.
Like it hasn't happened to you.
I should have brought one. You might have fit in one, Rick. But then there are also the commenters who immediately write, those kids don't deserve to have a nice prom. Those kids don't. What are they complaining about?
Just look at them.
they're all good for nothing. Hooligans.
Is it a dumb question? Where you said it's an outer southeast Portland. Where actually is – I know it's in three different places, but I mean, is it – are we talking
– it's three mini campuses at one school. It's out off Southeast 91st.
Mm-hmm. All right,
and
so.
Near Southeast 91st and Powell.
Perhaps not a segment of Portland society that gets a lot of attention paid to it, you know, in terms of cash, you know, and welfare for the schools.
What,
anyway.
That's part of the city of Portland. Yes. Yes, it is.
All right. So that's online. If you want to read that, it's OregonLive.com. That is OregonLive.com. Quickly, did we all go to prom?
Oh, God. Yeah.
See, I just ask things like that for that reaction. That's the only reason I bring these things up. Just like it's sort of like, ugh. It's like you've just, you know what it is?
I went with a friend of mine who was gay, and I had to buy the tickets, and he spent the whole night jitterbugging with some other girl while I sat and talked to her date.
I'm not even going to tell my story now because it would just be lame. I think we've just peaked. You've led with your right there. Right. Anna Griffin, are there prom photos of you?
Unfortunately, yes.
What are you, and are you wearing are you wearing the dress? You're wearing the whole getup?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my mom was very excited about prom.
Was there a theme? Was there a song?
Oh, my senior year, it was Clapton. It was Wonderful Tonight.
Of course.
Yeah.
Excellent. Do you guys have graduation songs? Because we were denied that. We never had a graduation song, which I was always a little bitter about for some reason. It was like every high school had that but us.
I don't know. I didn't technically graduate. Is that true?
Did you get a GED or something?
Yeah, I took the GED.
Yeah, okay.
Because I wasn't going to any of my classes except for art and drama, and I was failing everything.
Yeah. I think you and I have talked about this before, that I had this huge huge, like the largest fight I ever had with my parents when I was like 16, because 16 was the age where you could, with parental consent, drop out of school. And I just like, it was just this argument that seemed to go on to like 5 in the morning, where I was just, I just had like a total meltdown about the fact that I did not want to go to high school anymore. And I was like ready to be done with it, just shut of it, and just take the GED and like move on with the rest of my stupid life without having to finish high school. And I was going to say, I don't know what they talked me out of it, but I think eventually they just said like, no. I think that was it. They finally went like, F this. No, you're staying. And then I did amazing. I graduated through the cunning use of correspondence courses, by the way, which strangely enough were offered. You know who runs most of the correspondence courses in this country? Like if you're some dirtbag kid who's not going to graduate from high school and your mom is just suddenly seeing like years of you living at home and she's just not on my watch. Like your mom turns into Esther Roll and says, oh, no. And, you know, and just immediately Brigham Young University. BYU actually has a thriving side business in creating, mailing out. I guess now they do online, but they would mail me just like, you know, like you have 5 apples. Bob takes 2, you know, and it's like I would fill them out, send them back, and an A. And that is the only reason that
wow.
I managed to,
nice.
You know. That and the fact that the final science credit that I needed to graduate from high school. Which was in this class called they called it technology science, but it was really, as I noted earlier this week for about math, it was science for like football players and skateboarders. The only reason, in addition to the correspondence course, I did this final science credit, and the teacher, I think, suspecting that there was no way that I would pass his class and graduate from high school otherwise, and like fearing that I would just linger there year after year like some sort of a scholastic barnacle, allowed me to do my finals as a oral presentation to the class, as a verbal presentation, and you know, and so it's like the least interesting version of stand and deliver you can possibly imagine, where he just let me go. And so anyway, that's what I learned about science. And he let me just babble for like 12 minutes and gave me a high enough grade. I think I needed like an 83 to graduate, and he gave me an 83. And that was just enough to get it
done. And look where you are now. So far removed from that.
Yes. And here I am wasting hours and hours and hours a week that people could be using, obtaining like actual knowledge.
And why is the hole bigger on a 45 than a 33?
Are you asking just to screw with me, or do you really want to know? Is it going to haunt you?
Can I find it on the internet?
You can find it on the internet. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor, ladies and
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
I forgot that we actually even do this.
Yeah, I know. We've been talking for like an hour and 20 minutes about, you know. This is just like at the end of the night when somebody goes, well, did you watch TV tonight? Yeah. What'd you watch? I don't know. And that's sort of this show sometimes.
Well, Mazda is recalling about 52,000 Mazda 6 sedans because yellow sack spiders like to build their nests in part of the fuel system. That would be spiders building their nests as part of the fuel system.
It was the phrase yellow sack that
yellow
really...
Yellow sack spiders. Mazda, in a letter to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, said a certain type of spider may weave a web in the evaporative canister vent line, and this may cause a restriction of the line. The evaporative canister vent line runs from a charcoal-filled canister that cleans air coming out of the gas tank.
Is there any explanation as to why the spiders? I mean, were they, in other words, was this like they got a batch of parts from somewhere and there were spiders in the box? Or is it like the components, the composite material they use to make it is somehow attractive to this kind of spider?
They're really not sure. It's specifically the model year 2009 and 2010 Mazda 6, and they really aren't sure why this particular spider prefers that model year of that car, because all modern cars have the same kind of equipment.
And the thing is, I don't know, and here's, I have like zero mechanical knowledge, so I don't really know how a car works or what anything is attached to. I don't know what it, but in my mind's eye, of course, it's the worst story ever, because I'm picturing just turning on the air conditioner and it's just blowing thousands of spiders at me.
See, well, that's what I think is all this the converter tube, it's nonsense. Somebody turned the car on, they turned the AC on, and millions of spiders came pouring out of the vents. That's what happened, people.
Well, actually, the problem apparently really is, though, that they're in this vent line that runs cleaning the air coming out of the gas tank, and they can block the line that prevents air from getting to the gas tank as the gas is used, creating negative air pressure, which could lead to a crack in the gas tank and the possibility of a fire. There have been 20 reported cases of spider infestations in the Mazda 6.
Are these like Are these like some sort of a arachnid suicide bombers where it's like they're being sent in just to sacrifice themselves for the greater cause, which is the advancement of their eight-legged brethren, by blocking the engine so the car just kind of, you know?
I don't know. And the people at Mazda are baffled. They said they have no idea why they like these particular models of this particular.
Just imagine the poor mechanic who goes in the first time someone comes in with a problem like this and is rooting around inside. And then
they get spiders in your gas tank.
Here's your problem. And then you just look at this. Yeah, and there's like a spider that's like 3 feet across just sitting on top of the engine going, hi. All right.
By the way, thanks to our chief of staff, Cheryl Kanakoa.
That's an ironic thanks,
for
by the way.
Say the thing. And there's a picture of your yellow sex spider.
Okay, now look, I would never do that to you. I would not just inflict a picture of a clown on you.
You would too.
When have I ever not warned you?
Well, all right.
Now look,
I did say this is a spider as I was turning it towards.
You didn't. If we were able to play this back, the referees in reviewing that film would come to a different conclusion.
There was a certain glee in the way she turned the laptop.
I should have said, "Would you like to see the spider?"
Here's what you did. You warned me about the spider as you were turning the computer the way that you like signal as you're already changing lanes. Yeah. That's what you did. Rick Emerson does not ever say, hey, look at this thing I won't. And then it's a picture of a clown.
I warned you about that. You're right. I wrongly inflicted the spider.
Would you like to see
the
spider? Because I would like to see you see the spider.
And then I say, like, yes or no, or maybe. Yeah, or okay.
I was wrong.
I'm just saying, now that's one you got coming.
The only thing worse than that, it would be a snake, right? Coming out of the air conditioner.
See, the thing about snakes is I'm not saying I'd be happy about that, but snakes in and of themselves don't freak me out the way that spiders, and I've mostly gotten over my spider fear, as I've gotten older. But that's a thing where it's like, you know what it is? I think the getting over the spider fear is maybe a little bit like getting over substance abuse or something, where it's like, you know, it's not a problem most of the time, but every now and again, you just kind of go, you get that little twinge. That's what I am with spiders. They weird me out.
They're just not right.
No,
we have a detente.
They
you know?
Are creepy, creepy looking animals. I'm actually not that afraid of spiders. My fear is stinging flying insects. Bees and wasps terrify me. I could probably handle if I looked down and like five or six spiders were like coming under the door, I'd be like, oh, that's wrong. But then I'd probably jump up and just stomp them. But if one bee came
my
in the room,
my back is to the door,
I would
you.
Freak out.
See, you're doing it again. Now you're just being passive about it. If I looked over and, for example, if Rick was just covered in spiders and didn't know it, it would unnerve me slightly.
But there are no spiders in this building. We know that.
Well, it's too late. Scratching myself. Why is it now? Have you had some sort of bad experience with flying things?
I think my mother. She believed that it was because because she was really scared of like bees, and when I was a little kid, she would try to pretend not to be, and so she told me once she believed that it actually made it more frightening to me because children can tell when parents are like trying to act like something's okay,
it's
all okay, don't be afraid, but really she was terrified, and it made it even scarier to me subconsciously. Yeah. I don't know if that's it or not, but yeah, I freak out when I just flying stingy things completely freak
me
out.
My children know I do not do spiders. I do not do snakes. If you see a spider, if you see a snake, please tell me so I can leave the room. I have no problem being weak in front of them.
It's probably – now, see, the thing is you're probably not going to like it. The snake isn't a thing you're going to encounter all that often, fortunately. No. It's not like – but I'm like, God damn. Somebody says, worst car feature ever.
Now with more snakes.
Company heads say they don't know what they were thinking when they installed the feature. And you just cut to a guy turning on the thing and spiders just go out of the
Are they going to rename the car the spider? Because that would make a lot of sense branding-wise. Yeah.
Our market research indicated that this would differentiate us from the competition.
Toyotas don't have a gas tank full of spiders.
To a guy covered in webs. What's like in Arizona? If you're like in Arizona, it's one of those things. This is the most horrifying thing. I have a friend of mine who lived in Arizona. And I think Bruce Agler lived in Arizona. Some relatives still live there, and he goes every now and again. But they say this thing about like Arizona, New Mexico, where like if you're getting up in the middle of the night, they said the one thing they tell you is like if you're getting up to use the bathroom or something, you don't walk, you slide your feet, you don't step. And I said, well, what do you mean you slide your feet? And they go, well, because that way if there's scorpions in the house, you kick them out of the way, you don't step on them. Which is like I could do without that knowledge. I'm not in Arizona. Here's the thing. I'm not gonna be in Arizona. Why would you tell me that?
It's like it's on trips to Mexico, and I remember going to Mexico with my parents as a small child, and being the whole thing of staying in some motel somewhere in the middle of nowhere in Mexico and always turning on the light before you go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, because you turn on the light and you just see things scatter out of the way.
Oh, God.
And yeah. when I went on a trip to Mexico with my mother when I was in my 20s, and we were in Cuernavaca, and there was this beautiful sunken tile tub in this place, and I got in the tub, and then all the lights went out. Like a fuse had blown in the hotel, and I was in this pitch black bathroom.
I hate you so much.
And I was just so convinced, and I just sat in the middle of the tub surrounded by water until the lights came on, and I wouldn't get out of the tub because I was convinced.
Because they come out at night.
I was convinced I would step on something if I got out of the tub.
You're in the middle of you're in pitch black, which there's things looming in the corners.
And my mom's like in the next room going, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I'm fine. I'm just staying in the water till the lights come back up. I'm good. Ugh. Don't worry about me."
God, when I was a kid, my parents, not just because they were cheapskates. I think my father also was on this quest. He was constantly on this quest to make me more manly. And so those two things conflated to result in every spring we would have to go up into the mountains, and we would have to – we didn't really cut down trees as such, but we would find like lumber, you know, like trees that had fallen over, you know, like, you know, and just trees that were either, you know, old or dead or that had collapsed or whatever. And we would cut them up, put them in the truck, take them home, and then we would have to just spend – you know, so you spend all day driving up there, all day finding trees or logs or whatever, cutting them up, all day loading the truck, driving it home, all day unloading the wood at home, and then like weeks, it seemed like, splitting and stacking the firewood, which just sucks in like 100 ways because you're covered in pitch, which never comes off your hand ever. It's there for weeks. I mean, it ruins your clothing, you know, and also, you know, I'm spindly and frail, and, you know, so that's just terrible. But then it's also the thing where it's like you've just got like 5 cords of firewood from the side of a mountain that isn't meant to be in the middle of like a regular city street. You know, and it's like you're just going through there, and it's like you're going into H.R. Giger's head. It's like every time you pick up a piece of, and it's eventually you just pick up, "Dad, there's another unholy creature from the deep. If you could just, the thing that should not be is under this log. If you come over," and I mean, it was so awful. And parents, they just don't. You just, that thing where they just go, "Oh, you're so cute with your fear of spiders," and they just don't realize the way that those. You probably done that, and then we have to get off the spider thing.
Okay.
But if you've done this where it's like you're asleep at night or you're in bed or whatever, and you get that like half dream where like, you know, something, probably your own hand or whatever, or a blanket, brushes your face, and you're convinced it's a spider. You know, 2 a.m, like a thing goes like and brushes your cheek, you're like, "Oh, it's a spider," and you go into lockdown, and you're like batting it, and I am 38 years of age, covering my head with the blankets and then just not, refusing to come out for like an hour because I'm convinced the spider is dangling from the ceiling above my bed.
Yeah, the worst thing is when you actually do find a spider, like in your bed or whatever, and it disappears before you can like kill it or catch it. And now you know it's in the room and it's somewhere in the vicinity of the bed. And it's like 1 o'clock in the morning and you have to go to sleep. And so it's like now it's like that whole thing of going, if I turn off the light and get to bed, it will come after me.
It's in
here somewhere.
It's like wait until dark. It's just you're sort of like it's there, you're there, but no one knows where.
And so every time, every moment before you fall asleep, if you feel the slightest thing like brush you, you go, "Spider!" You know, and it's horrible.
Well, because
it's just
you figure that they're malicious. I mean, that's the thing is you ascribe malice to spiders, or at least I do, and wasps too. That's the thing is you look at a wasp, you go, "Yeah, it's like wasps and bees are sort of like rats and mice." Well, one just stings you. One is evil, though.
Yeah.
And it's like I don't have the bee thing, but the wasp thing and like, or yellow jackets. And I know there's a whole thing about wasps or yellow jackets and yellow jackets or wasps or whatever. But they're just, terrifying.
They are just, they'll come after you. Or it's they're just evil. And bees are just kind of like, oops, sorry, got in your space. I'll sting you now. But the wasps and yellow jackets, they just spot you and they go, I'm going to get you.
You wake up in the morning and you have a spider bite, which means something was sitting on you, by the way, and you didn't, and biting you while you slept. I mean, what is up with that? We have to stop. We have to be done.
Okay. Where do you people live?
Hell. I live in Southeast Portland, which,
I have a lot less problems with stingy things and spiders and stuff now that I no longer own a 100-year-old house and I live in a nice apartment. So I don't – now I just have to watch out when I walk outside because there's lots of trees and stuff outside and I live on the ground floor and the spiders really like to build stuff outside my door under, like, by the light. But in the apartment, the inside of the apartment is relatively pest-free. The old drafty house, on the other hand, used to just be crawling with stuff all of the time, and it was horrible.
I have this – I live in this sort of – Southeast, one of those, you know, like one of those weird, like, antebellum homes. It seems like it was built, like, 9 million years ago. Not so much that the city will replace it with something new, but old enough that it seems like the house is porous in a strange way. But, you know, and I don't get much in the house. Like, we get, you know, I've shown you the side of the house and the garden or whatever. We get all the spiders, which, again, we have a sort of uneasy truce because the acknowledgement I came to, the understanding is that, like, you know, our garden gets filled with spiders and huge webs, which are kind of gross and kind of scary. But we don't we leave them there because of the recognition that they keep a lot of other crawling things out of the house. And it's like, look, as long as you're not in the house, as
this
long
is
as
your
you're out
space.
Here. Yeah.
And I occupy my space.
And as long as you're out here, you're not in my place, I'm not in yours, you're doing your job of keeping other things out of the house.
Is there a neutral zone?
Yeah, there's 3 foot. Yeah, if they get within, like, where, like, you open the door and you're going to hit them, like, we hose them away. But it's like, as long as they're in the garden, we're like, you know, you do your job there, I'll do my job here, we'll be fine. But what I do have is a garage that I have never cleaned. And it's a garage with just a cracked cement floor and cracked cement walls. And it's just basically, like, it's just a place for putting bodies. And I've never really – like, we don't park the car in there because it's just filled with old cinder blocks, you know? And at some point, I'm going to have to make space in there for something. And it's like I just – there aren't enough, like, raid bug bombs in the world to make me feel good about going into that garage. I mean, it's like you've – that is where you realize in some weird way – you know, you realize why Agent Orange exists, you know, because you at a certain point you go like, I don't know what's in there, but I'm not going to let it get the, you know, what do we have that'll just make sure that everything down there is taken care of? What? Cancer? Ah, fine. We'll figure that out later. You know, that's what I want to do to my garage. And you can't buy any of that stuff anymore. It's all illegal and so forth.
Dangerous.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Have we taken a break? We have taken a break. We
no.
took before we brought Anna in.
Did we? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Here's what we got coming up. We got to talk about last night's. Do you watch Justify with Timothy Oliphant by chance?
No.
So we'll maybe keep it a little bit briefer than normal. We don't want to just put you into some sort of somnambulistic coma or whatever. As we got that, we'll do the top five, which we have to do. We have to do it because I've been putting off for like 2 days.
Never going to get to ask my meat question.
You can ask your meat question right now if you'd like. Would you like to ask a meat question?
Yes.
Let's just say this, that the meat question you're going to hear in moments is brought to you by Squires Electric. That is Squires Electric. You can contact them at 503-252-1609. That is 503-252-1609. Somebody suggests that we start using the phrase, for all your wires, go to Squires.
Huh.
I have to think I'm not going to do it, but I appreciate the input. Phineas, thanks so much. Squires Electric can be contacted at squireselectric.com, or you can call them at 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, installers, and supervisors. What does that mean? Well, it means before you can go out and just be, you know, screwing around with the wires in a guy's house, you have to do what is the electrical equivalent of passing the bar. And as Joe Squires himself told us, 97% of people fail that the first time out. He himself passed it with flying colors. He's one of the 3% that passed it the first time. He's a guy who knows what he, and you know, and you will. This is the sense you got of him. You talk to Joe Squires for like 12 seconds, and he just has that bearing of a guy who knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's not showy. He's not like always dropping a lot of $12 words on you about it, but he just says something about electricity, and you go like, this guy completely knows what he's talking about. And you know that there's no reason. I mean, that it's just like the height of absurdity for you to try to fix your electrical system at home yourself when a guy like that is available. I mean, really, that's it. I mean, it's like you've got a magical device in your home, maybe in your hand right now. You dial 10 numbers, bam, a sort of electrical great gazoo just appears at your house and just fixes whatever needs to be. I mean, it really is amazing when you think about it. Something's broken. You pick up a little thing. It's like the size of like a coaster. You press some buttons. Guy appears on the front porch, fixes the thing. You could probably at this point just press a couple other buttons on the thing. He's paid. And then he just sort of flits away back to whence he came. I mean, it really is a golden age in which you live. So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is it is an affront to both science and God if you don't take advantage of these developments and call Squires Electric. It's 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. It is squireselectric.com. They are the proud sponsors of this. Don Taylor's question for you about meat. Don?
Now, the pedigree of this question, I'm not sure if I'm getting this correctly, but I'll try. Fatboy Roberts was a guest on the podcast The Mediocre Show out of Philadelphia, which is hosted by Eric Tomorrow, who I believe is actually a listener.
Is that into Philadelphia?
Yes.
See, because that guy, Eric Tomorrow, he's been, you know, I've gotten emails from him for a long time. I didn't know he was in Philadelphia. I guess I assumed he was here for some reason.
Yeah, well, the show originates in Philadelphia, so I assume he's there. Hmm. So, but anyway, Fat Boy was a guest on their podcast, The Mediocre Show. And this question came up, which we discussed yesterday on Ham Fisted Radio, which is, if you could only eat the products from one animal for the rest of your life, like you get one animal. Cow, pig, chicken, what have you. And you could have the byproducts of no other animal but that animal. Which one would you choose?
Cow.
Because of milk? Or just because of...
Well, because of milk. I mean, I'm tempted to say pig, you know, because pigs. But I think that really, in the grand scheme of things, I think that if I had to just go to either red meat or pork, you know, in terms of meat, I think red meat is probably... That's probably more where my personal interests, you know, my tastes, my culinary tastes lie. I don't know. That's my first answer.
See, because that's the thing with chickens, you also get eggs,
so
you have a wider range of things you can make.
I hadn't really thought about that. No, that's a good point. Except, well, you got eggs. So wait a minute. Are you saying that I would then have to eschew products of all other mammals?
Right. So you would never, if you've chose the chicken, for example,
choose the cow.
You would never have cow's milk. You would never have bacon.
You're vegan, pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay. Now that is an interesting question. I don't know. Well, let me, here's, this sounds stupid, but I don't really know anything about cooking. So, in terms of like baking and whatnot, I mean, it sounds silly, but how important are eggs? Like, is that a thing you can just skip and add like more milk or something?
Well, not really. You can't get the same kind of baked goods that you have now because they provide a certain amount of protein, but also some leavening. So you'd have very flat, very dense breads and such.
Wow. You know, the egg thing might make it so that I have to go with chicken. I just don't know. Anna Griffin?
I think chicken's the way to go because you need eggs. So many things in the eggs. You can get your milk elsewhere. I mean, it's true. Although you lose cheese.
Yeah.
So you lose the cow. You lose
that's
cheese,
true.
And that's a big deal.
You know, and I'm going to go back to cow. This just makes it sound like I have no... I just sound like one of those, like... I sound like one of those people with a dial and a political focus group where it's like, whoever spoke last, I think that they're awesome. 100%. I think, looking at it now, though, I do believe, even taking into account baked goods, I think I consume more cheese than I do eggs, though. Because I love me some cheese. I mean, that is a thing I eat just, like, way more of than I should, probably. That's really one of my weaknesses. I think more cheese than eggs, even, again, because you can get around the issue of eggs. It's probably not very good, but you can get baked stuff that doesn't have eggs. Vegan cheese is, like, the worst thing on earth.
Oh. Yeah.
So, I don't think I can.
Also.
Back to cow.
Chocolate.
Yes. Mm. Also that.
See, I hadn't really thought... you can do dark chocolate, because dark chocolate does not have milk products in it.
Is that
so
true?
That's true.
Well, I guess milk chocolate, dark chocolate.
Right.
Yeah.
My Angela, and I'm waffling on this, but I think I ended up being on team pork. Because I kind of thought, you know, yes, I'm giving up cheese and eggs, but the meats that come off of the pig are so damned delicious. And you got your pork loin, you got your pork chops, you got your bacon, you got your pork rinds if you want something crunchy. But I'm just saying...
Pickled pig's feet.
Yeah, there are so many delicious... The sausages and such. There's so many delicious meats that come from the pig that I honestly think I could probably give up dairy just to be able to eat pork for the rest of my life.
I don't know. This is such a Hobson's choice. I
know. Isn't it a tough question?
The more I think about it, I think I would keep a cow in the backyard were this apocalyptic nightmare to come true.
And so now people are just saying what you do without. Like, no cows means no sour cream. Mm-hmm. You know, what good is bacon without eggs?
There are people who spend their lives...
Bacon is plenty good without eggs.
I mean,
thank you very
bacon
much.
Is really
bacon
oh,
is yeah. good with anything.
Yeah, bacon is pretty much... That's a one-stop solution to everything right there. I think, to me, cheese, though, is the deal breaker. Because I know that one of the things, like, they'll always, like, they tell you in the health classes, like in nutrition class, they always say, remember, people, cheese is a garnish, not an ingredient. And it may be in your house. In my house, cheese is like the whole meal sometimes.
How often do you find yourself going... Oh, man, there's not enough cheese on this.
Yeah.
A lot.
You know, here's the thing. I think, was it you and I that have talked about, the Domino's pizza and how, like, their constant attempts to sort of, constant and sort of sadly comedic attempts to improve it, but it's like we all know that it's terrible.
Yeah.
And I got into a whole discussion about chain pizza. Despite the fact that I don't really care for a lot of a lot of big chain pizzas as such. I mean, they're not like it's the worst thing on earth if you have to eat something from Pizza Hut or whatever, but it's not really good. Not like a thing I want to go out of my way to do. But I will tell you this, that crust with the cheese inside, that's how much, I mean, even, and that's like yeah. that fake rubber string cheese stuff, and it's still awesome.
The first time I ever had that was one of my bachelor nights when Patrick was off on his gaming thing, and I said, I'm going to order a pizza. And you know, I don't do this very often, so to me it is still one of the most decadent things in the world to just have the guy come to my house and bring me a pizza, and I'm alone. This entire pizza is just for me.
Oh, yeah. No,
I mean, granted, I got to leave some so Patrick can have some when he gets home, but really,
really,
right now, this pizza is mine. And
Wait, hold on. What do you mean you have to leave? I've never chosen this way of life. What do you mean leave some?
We
have an understanding?
We have this whole understanding about food that actually led to an argument this week when I did not leave him any apple crisp that I made.
Well, now you have to tell us.
We have this kind of it's almost unspoken, except that it has caused discussion. So it is spoken that there are two of us in this household, and if someone buys something that is especially delicious, the proper and polite thing to do is to leave half of it for the other.
Right.
And also, you know, you don't drink the end of the milk without saying anything.
Sure.
Like, I'm going to finish off the milk. And so we do that. Like, you know, I come home and Pat's like, I got a pizza. I left you half. You know, and it's like, yay, there's your half of the pizza. That kind of thing. If I order a pizza and he's not there, I'm supposed to leave him half the pizza. So I did. I was home last week and he was out, and it was like, I think, my Thursday night. And I was like, I really wanted some kind of dessert bad. I was craving some sort of dessert just insanely. And he had taken the car and I was at home and was alone. And I thought,
I should note that your hands became claws just now as you were saying that.
There's got to be something I can do with like apples and the things we have in the house. And I went online and discovered there's this like total white trash apple crisp thing you can make by dumping a box of Cape Mix over a bunch of sliced apples.
Wow.
And then putting the crumbly stuff on top and drizzling butter all over the whole thing. So I tried it, and it was delicious. And I ate like a couple. And it just made this small little thing. And I ate some of it. And Patrick said, oh, you made this thing. I said, yes, I did. And he went to work the next morning. And then I ate the rest of it for breakfast.
Oh.
And he came back later, and he's like,
No.
You ate all of that yourself? And I said, yes, I did. But I did not feel guilty about this, because in 11 years of marriage, this is the first time I have ever not left him half of something, whereas he has not left me half of things a whole lot of times. So I just, all I could do is just look at him and go, yeah, it feels bad, doesn't it? Yeah, it sucks,
like,
doesn't it?
Angrily pointing at me just now when you did that too.
So he tried to make me feel bad about it. It was like, I refuse to feel bad. And I just kept going, remember the grapes? Remember that time with the grapes? You know, so.
All right. No, I can get that. See, but I think that Laura and I have sort of the same thing, but my solution is just to consume the entire pizza and then hide the box.
Pizza?
Yes.
What pizza?
That's exactly. Well, it's like, but see, that's my thing. It's like, if she cannot miss what she didn't know was there. You know, and it's like, if she had no reason, in other words, if she has no reason to think that there's going to be pizza and had no reason to believe that there was pizza while she was gone, ergo, no reason to expect pizza when she walks in the door, there is no pizza. QED.
Now,
the
do you take the go to the extra mile of taking the pizza container and rearranging the trash so it's on the
well,
bottom?
Oh, tell her about the trunk pizza, Rick.
Well, now, I've had several different techniques that I've rotated through over the years. At one point, I was just if I would finish the pizza like in toto, I would just consume the entire thing. At one point, I would just take the pizza boxes, and I don't know why I started. I think it's because at one point she came home early.
Busted.
And there's like that whole thing of like some guys were like, you came home early, then I had to turn off the porn, I had to hide the booze, For me, it's like I hear the keys in the lock, and I'm like, oh my god! So I just took the pizza box, which I think was empty, thank God, and I stuck it behind the refrigerator. But then it's like several of them ended up being stuck there by me over the next, you know, whatever. And then the refrigerator stopped working, which is the strangest thing. So I couldn't put I couldn't put pizza boxes back behind the new fridge anymore, or ever talk to the landlord. So then recently, it was like a couple weeks ago where I had ordered a pizza, which seemed like a good idea at the time. And I think in retrospect, it was a good idea. But I think either I was just not as hungry as I thought I was, or it was the pizza was bigger than I thought it would be, or whatever. It was that whole time when the woman delivered the pizza came in, and I realized that I didn't have any cash.
Yeah.
And it looked like I was trying to lure her into the house with my credit cards. It was all creepy. But I only ended up eating a couple pieces, and then it's like, you know, I look at a bunch of, oh, she's going to be home any minute now. So I ended up just putting the pizza in the trunk of my car. But, of course, it's a huge pizza that I'd ordered because they wouldn't deliver a medium.
Right.
That's the thing is, a medium you had to go pick up. And I'm like, F that. So they, I'll get a large. So they delivered a large to my house. So now I have way more pizza, and I've eaten a lot of it, but it's like, you know, but I think we had decided that we were eating a little too much pizza, so we weren't really going to have any, and I think I broke that rule. So I'm like, oh, my shame is on three different levels. So I hid the pizza in the trunk of my car, and then
and
it's like—
And to be fair, the weather was very cold. It was one of those, like horrible winter periods.
So the,
where
the
was,
pizza would keep in the
yeah,
trunk?
Yeah, so it was like 26 degrees outside, so it was actually refrigeration temperature in the trunk of his car.
And I'm just, like, and the thing is, I'm just such a colossal cheapskate, especially with food, where I just cannot bring myself to throw food away. Or if there's, like, a quarter of an inch of something left in the bot, or, like, cereal crumbs, it's like I'll dump them into my hand. So I couldn't get rid of it.
The whole conversation about this happened as by way of him explaining why, right before the show, he had parked his car, then opened his trunk, pulled out a slice of pizza, and then walked up the street eating a slice of pizza that he'd just gotten out of his trunk.
Well, so it became like a mobile fridge where I kept the pizza until it was gone.
That's brilliant.
You know,
brilliant.
And it's like, because what am I, you know, I mean, what am I going to do? I can't even put it in here. It'll be gone. You know, it will be consumed by other people who did not pay for it. You know, if I put it at home, then it's like my shame is known. And so trunk pizza, you know, and which, by the way, there was for like an hour and a half after that show, there was a trunk pizza hashtag on Twitter. So just
and by the way, if you give me a moment to find this, we actually got an email regarding trunk pizza just today.
Really?
Yes. From alert listener Michael, who said, he wrote to us twice today, by the way. Let's see.
What are the odds that a guy would be writing about trunk pizza?
Here we go. I'm a couple of weeks behind, but I had to tell you about my recent trip to my old man's store, Bi-Mart. When I was walking through the parking lot, I saw a lady putting stuff in the trunk of her car, and I noticed a pizza box. When I walked by, she looked at me, and I pointed at the pizza box and said, "Trunk pizza." And she said, "Trunk pizza." Thinking she might be a listener, I then said, "Best show ever." And she just looked at me and said, "What?"
Awesome.
Feeling a little embarrassed, I went into Bi-Mart to pick up my prescription for antidepressants and 21 rounds of ammo.
Okay. This has been Dawn Taylor Asks You About Meat. Right here at the Rick Emerson Radio Program, brought to you by Squires Electric. And I'm just taking up air that, like, useful people could be using.
I didn't finish, by the way, and I did want to say the cheese in the crust.
Yeah.
The first time I had it was during that whole glorious a whole pizza for myself, and
right.
I said I'm going to get the one with the cheese in the crust. And the thing about the cheese in the crust, yeah, it is kind of rubbery, but if you get it while the pizza is fresh and still hot, it is the most amazing, delicious
really
thing ever.
And I don't even mind like the sort of rubberiness of it. Like in a way, I like that because I like the textural difference between the crust and the cheese itself. And plus, I think they have to do that because I think if it was not that way, when you bit into it, it would like run onto your lap or your hand and burn you or stain your clothes or something. You can't just have like cheese pouring out of something you're biting into. I mean, you could and it would be great, but it would also be messy. So I think to keep down messiness and maybe burning yourself with cheese that sort of spills or squirts or something, they have to. But it's really, I mean, that's a thing. I am unashamed about that. And that is what makes this country, you know, that is what makes us the envy of all other nations. Cheese inside of a thing already covered with cheese, and they'll bring it to your house for like $5.
You know where all that government-bought cheese that you used to hear about
yes.
wound up?
Inside of Pizza Hut?
That's right.
Here's the thing. I just say this because it's true. People talk about government cheese. Government cheese is the best cheese you will ever have in your life. I mean, relatively speaking. I mean, in terms of your like readily available mainstream cheeses, your government cheese is some of the best. Have you had government cheese?
I have never had government cheese.
Government cheese, which they also call welfare cheese, which I don't think is actually for people at welfare. But it's like, if you know, you just take the thing in and they give you the, you know, what? You're starving. Here you go. And they give you the government cheese is excellent. Because that is like, because the thing about the government food that they'll give you on the like the food is in the, that is all like grade A. I mean, that's like, it's not like a prison food or something. That is like top of the line food. And the dairy that you get from the government is excellent.
Well, it wasn't. It's the cheese that the government has purchased because as a nation, we reached a point where we're eating less cheese, and yet the dairy farmers were still producing all that cheese.
It's a subsidy cheese.
It's a subsidy cheese,
yeah. I just love the idea, though, that it wasn't for a long period of time. But when I was a kid, there was this brief window of time. Both my parents were unemployed. They didn't have a lot of money. And so and then, you know, and kids, and what are they going to do? So they got the government cheese and the government whatever, which even as a kid— And I mean, this hasn't dimmed at all with the passing years. Even as a child, I remember thinking, I don't even know that I would call it a swell of patriotism, because it seems like that was a bit of an esoteric concept for me to have grasped at that age. But I remember just thinking, like, what a great government we have, that they actually, like, cheese is considered such a state, it's a national resource, that, like, they have warehouses of cheese just in case you should run out and you can't buy your own. I mean, it's like they don't do that with healthcare, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like if you run out of healthcare, they go, sorry. But if you run out of cheese, they're like, come by and we'll give you some. I mean, you can't go without cheese. So, I mean, it's really the idea that, like, they only do that with lawyers. I mean, it's like lawyers and cheese. If you can't afford it, it will be given to you. Everything else is secondary. Lawyers and cheese, though, are what makes this country run.
That cut. Just slap a piece of cheese on it. There you go.
You know, yeah. Hey, and look.
You know why you're sick? You don't eat enough cheese.
If you got some dread illness, you know, but a guy gives you a block of Pepper Jack, that at least, you know, you will die a little bit happy, a shade happier. We, on Outlook Portland last week, we talked to Grant Butler, from the food writer from The Oregonian, who he just passed his first year, and he's now on his 1 year, 1 month of going vegan. And the thing that made it, no pun intended, like palatable for me to hear him talk about that is that he was very much by his own admission a meat and potatoes guy, you know, and not just because, you know, grew up in Kansas City, but that was just what he ate. He ate a lot of, like, you know, very like a lot of red meat and a lot of like starchy sort of potato type staples and cheese. And, you know, and so when he says that he went vegan, you know, and it was actually pretty great, I mean, you know, that's okay. You can put some weight on that because he's not just some, like, zealot about it, and he doesn't have an agenda for it. I did ask him, though. I said, you know, is there any – other than something obvious like steak or whatever, is there anything that they don't – that there is no analog that really works? Like, there is no vegan equivalent that is worth its salt. And he just said – he said cheese is the one thing. He said even, like, the vegan bacon is sort of palatable in a strange sort of way. It's like the vegan cheese, there's just nothing. It's like it's just like this horrible, like – it doesn't really even melt. It just becomes like – it just becomes like that chocolate house the guy lived in Willy Wonka, where it just sort of like sags a little bit and then becomes lumpy, and that's it. So I'm just saying. I'm exhausted. What if we should do a few more news stories here. Then we will briefly touch on Justified. We'll do the top five, and then we'll bring the curtain down on this exercise in a juvenile inanity. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Let's do our clergy watch.
Here is your clergy watch for Thursday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Well, I guess it would be nice. I gotta have faith. Ooh, I gotta have faith. Because I gotta have faith. I gotta have faith.
Was it you that told me that George Michael was on, like, American Idol or something recently? Or am I making that up in my head? Seems like he was on something. He made some of the public appearance.
No, he's going to be one of the judges on the new X Factor.
That's right. Okay. I will totally. Here's the thing. I will watch. Even Steven Tyler hasn't got me to watch, but I will watch for George Michael. Because he's like a train wreck, but also because he's a guy who knows a lot about music and has no problem speaking bluntly, but from the perspective of somebody who does really understand what he's talking about. And he doesn't mince a lot of words. So I will absolutely watch that.
Reverend Edward Fairley and Reverend Simone Shields of Paterson, New Jersey, worked at the same church and at some point, according to police, were in a relationship. Tuesday morning, Reverend Fairley stormed into an Eastside home and, without a word, stabbed Reverend Simone Shields several times in the face and torso, leaving her to lie in a pool of blood on the kitchen floor.
This is one reverend stabbing another?
Yes.
Okay, and they were in a relationship?
Yes.
Did it say what?
And they worked at the same church.
Which denomination does it say?
Baptist.
Okay.
Shields, 52, was eventually rescued by police and taken to St. Joseph's Regional Medical Center. She remains in critical but stable condition. Fairley, 59, was arrested after he was spotted on the street, soaked in blood, the knife still in his hand. He's charged with attempted murder and is in police custody with no bail set. The attack stunned the city's church leaders. Fellow pastors who described Fairley as a good man and a pillar in the community seemed at a loss. But long before he started at the Koinonia and Christian Ministries in Patterson 15 years ago, Fairley was convicted of committing a violent act on his wife. In 1983, Fairley, then 32 and a Baptist minister, was indicted on charges of breaking into his estranged wife's apartment and stabbing her, according to an article published in the New York Times in 1983.
So is the clergy just like, is it just some sort of like a moral car wash that you can just sort of, you know, it's like a portal into which you can vanish if you, it is not unlike Bill Carter talking about like every third guy you meet in those Alaskan fishing villages is like on the lam for some reason and calling himself Carlos, even though his driver's license is Tim.
Well, it's one of those things. I think the whole religious community, whether you're talking about being in the clergy or even just joining Alcoholics Anonymous or something, I think there's this tendency that if you say, well, I led a bad life,
right.
I did some bad things.
A different man then.
But now God is on my side.
I would say once you're, you know, once a stabber, probably always a stabber.
You'd think.
That's not an aberration in your behavior most of the time.
Yeah, this fellow served 6 years in prison for aggravated assault, kidnapping, armed burglary, and weapons possession. He now leads a sizable congregation that runs food pantries and other charities. He's apparently also a gifted musician, and, you know, they have musical services and such. But, yeah, it's unclear about when Fairley and Shields began their relationship. He was married. She was not, although a former student said she was about to get engaged as of December. And something happened between the two. And he wanted some personal papers from her of some sort, showed up, attacked her in the kitchen with a knife he pulled out of his pocket. And
I was going
to
ask.
And then, according to a person who was there, a hairstylist who was visiting the woman at the time, after he stabbed the woman, he quietly left.
Sort of, you know, didn't want to make a fuss or a ruckus.
No.
I was going to ask if you're allowed to be married when you're about to, but I guess they weren't married anyway. They did not have the benefit of marriage regardless of their relationship status. So
he was married. She was not, but something was going on with him, and he just showed up and stabbed her.
Let me ask you this. And here's the thing. We've talked about this many times. I mean, like, if you're – this is just like a confidential to – in this case, to women everywhere. Like, if you're with a guy who's, you know, the stabby or the punchy type, I mean, here's the thing. Like, whether you say it out loud or not, you probably know that. You probably know that you're with a guy who solves things, you know, by just giving you a bunch of fives. If that is the case, you're better served by leaving sooner, I think, rather than later.
Yeah, one thing I think that I learned both through watching other people's relationships and through my own relationships, and it's something that no one, you know, I think will understand until they've been through it, but is worth thinking about at least, is that if you are with a gentleman and he has done horrible things to a woman in the past, if he talks about his past relationships as being horrible, even if he blames everything on them,
especially if he blames everything on them.
But especially if, according to him, every major relationship he has been in has ended badly. And then as an addendum, ask him how he feels about his mother.
Also, if he uses the phrase, well, you know, men just don't got no rights in this country, then, you know.
Yeah, odds are it is not going to go well for you either.
Yeah, there's a poking with something sharp coming your way.
Yeah.
So, you know, just get in your Volare and abscond.
In any situation, if you are dating someone, if you are dating a gentleman, you are in a heterosexual relationship and dating a gentleman, on the first date, just pull it out on the first date. Ask him how he feels about his mother. What's his relationship with his mother?
Also, have you ever stabbed anyone?
Yeah, well, that too. But my experience has always been that if a man has nothing but horrible things to say about his mother, he is not going to have a good attitude towards women in general.
How about if he has too many good things to say about his mother?
That might be a little problematic in a completely different way.
Her skin was so soft, it was like butter. Sometimes, you know, late at night when the moon was full, I would just – and you go, oh, that's great. I got to use the bathroom.
No, we get along great. I slept in her bed till I was 15.
Mother will love you.
She's out in the car right now.
Lately, her voice just sounded a lot
trunk
like mine,
with the pizza.
Though. See, what is wrong with us that we all immediately go to some variation of the Ed Gein reference? There's your clergy watch for Thursday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Because I got to have faith.
Uh, It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Well, let's do this. Let's take a very brief break here. We'll come back on the other side and get the final big push, as they say on Blackadder. Here we've got the your Justified recap coming up, also the top five, and more with Anna Griffin from the Oregonian. Stay there. We return momentarily. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Well, it used to be bad. I was born to lose, and my traveling shoes was the only shoes I had. Well, it used to be cool. I was that Sunday afternoon, sunk and drunk and stumbling fool, till I met your mama. She pulled me out of that terrible fix. Well, I know daddy's been away a while, cause it's been hard to teach an old dog new tricks. I tell your mama your dad done quit his drinking. Tell your mama your dad done found the Lord. Tell your mama your dad done quit his cussing, his fighting, his carrying on. But don't you tell your mama, goddamn, your daddy's born. Well, it used to be sly. I'd stay out all night. Now I love to fight and make them young girls cry. Well, it used to be cruel. I was rude, glued, screwed, tattooed, down and dirty with a just plain surly attitude. Till I met your mama, she pulled me out of that terrible fix. Well, I know daddy's been away a while, cause it's been hard to teach an old dog new tricks. I tell your mama your daddy done quit his drinking. Tell your mama your daddy done found the Lord. Tell your mama your daddy done quit his cussing, his fighting, his carrying on. But don't you tell your mama, goddamn, your daddy's bored. Well, if a thousand times I've seen the light, you know that I've gone blind a thousand times again. And if a thousand times I said I do, you know I turned my tail a thousand one again. I didn't mean no harm, I was just having fun again.
Listening to the Emerson News Network.
Some days I feel like my shadow's casting me. Some days the sun don't shine. Sometimes I wonder what tomorrow's gonna bring when I think about my dirty life and times. One day I came to a fork in the road. Folks, I just couldn't go where I was told. Now they'll hunt me down and hang me for my crimes if I tell about my dirty life and times. We'll be right back. It's hard to find a girl with a heart of gold when you're living in a four-letter world. But if she won't love me, then her sister will. She's from Say One Thing and Need Heaven's Hill. And she can't seem to make up her mind. She hears about my dirty life and times. Woo! Some days I feel like my shadow's casting. Some days the sun don't shine.
Don't shine.
Sometimes I wonder why I'm still running free. All up and down the line. Gets a little lonely, folks, you know what I mean. I'm looking for a woman with low self-esteem. Lady, I've eased my worried mind. I'm winding down my dirty life and times. Ooh, lady, I've eased my worried mind. While I'm winding down my dirty life and times.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio.
Sorry.
Program. Something exciting over there?
I'm excited we're back.
Okay. It's 503-505-6964. We're here with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Reader in print of The Oregonian or online at OregonLive.com. And tomorrow is the piece about the house concerts.
Yes.
House, which, and I think I made a, I think I made some sort of a glow stick reference, which is just a way, a slight way of updating my kid and play references that normally would be rolled out for any sort of a house concert, a house party reference. Did you know that the original House Party movie played at Sundance? Just think on that for a while. The next time you, believe that you understand how the world works, it's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me, Comedy 101. That is coming up tomorrow. Here in just a skosh, we'll do your fourth clue for this week's Name That Snack contest from EH Vending, and we'll do the the justified recap actually as the next thing. But I guess somebody just pointed out that I am. At the top of the show, I said that I would. I said that I would recap my audition.
Oh yeah,
and I didn't. There's, I mean, the recapping is just, you know. So I yesterday, it was actually right after the show. I had an audition for Leverage, which is strange, and we already noted that it was a little bit bizarre because I was on the show once, and so it's, I'm either playing the same guy, in which case I just did such a terrible job. That it's like, it's that whole thing of like going, I don't know. I'm going to have to make you audition all over again for this.
Because we're a Rick Emerson type, not necessarily Rick Emerson.
Do you have like a brother who maybe has skills in the acting arena? Or I'm playing somebody else, in which case that also makes no sense because then there's like some sort of rift with the, like the space-time continuum in the Leverage world.
It's like Portland's Law and Order.
I think I actually figured it out though because you did you were auditioning for Embittered Millionaire.
Yes.
And they thought, you know, that Emerson, the newscaster, he has his own suit.
Yes, yes. No, not just a suit. A suit with a continental flavor to it,
right.
Dawn. So I show up yesterday, and it's like, you know, well, you and you know, you saw me. I was like looking at the clock, trying to figure out exactly like what's the latest I can leave because they already, those things typically go to around 3, and they already push them a little bit later for people who are just like slack asses who can't get there on time. So you know, it's like 3:45 or whatever. And so I'm like, okay, we'll wrap it up like 3:25, and you had to go to your thing. So I get done. But of course, it just takes like 9 times longer to get ready than you know than I think, and you know I can never put on my shoes correctly the first time, and so I you know get all my stuff, and I'm grabbing my like my script with my one went with my one line. I'm sorry, my two lines.
Two lines.
By the way, the second line, a single word. But said with only the conviction that I can muster. So I get out of the car, and I'm driving there, and of course, then I can never find any parking. And so it's this whole thing where I'm just running later and later. And I'm looking at my watch and just thinking, oh, now I'll never get to play the embittered millionaire. And I'm parked the car, and it's like I've got all my stuff, and I've got my bag and my whatever. And then I look down, and it's like I realize that first of all I've buttoned my shirt, but I've done at least I realize before I going in I've buttoned the shirt like crooked, where it's like the buttons are all one off. So it's like I have to. So I'm outside the casting place, unbuttoning my shirt, and then having to rebutton my shirt. So anybody watching you at that moment, by the way, knows exactly what you're doing. There is no, I just liked the buttons in a slightly different fashion. Like, they know that you're just functionally illiterate and can't dress yourself. So I'm there, and I'm adjusting my shirt and whatever. And then, of course, I'm wearing a black shirt, which is ill-advised because I have two small white dogs. And so everything – and it's like the shirt had just been washed, ironed, whatever. But I did that the night before, and I just hung it, overnight. But it's that thing of, like, when you own dogs, the hair just, like, fills the air somehow, like some sort of a canine snow globe. And it just – latches onto the shirt. And so I look down and I'm just covered in like white poodle hair. But fortunately, I was prepared because I had brought one of those adhesive lint rollers, which really, when you think about it, I mean, right there with the cheese pizza crust with the extra inside, the lint roller, and not just the brushy kind, I'm talking the adhesive kind, that is one of the great inventions of like the last 20 years.
The two-sided masking tape on a roll, basically, and then you peel the pieces off as they become furry.
I mean, that's the thing, because otherwise you're doing what every guy does, where it's like you find some scotch tape and you wrap your hand in scotch tape, and then you're going...
Oh, not just guys, Rick Emerson.
Really? Does Don Taylor do that every now and again? Does it take out mustard stains?
No, I have a wide array of things to take out my many food stains.
I just like the idea that that was your take on the embittered millionaire.
Well, he's a guy covered in lint.
Kind of crazy, actually.
Well, he has a whole lot of Lhasa Apso's that he carries with him everywhere.
It's like a Howard Hughes interpretation that you were doing.
So the best part is though that I've got this shirt and I finally got the buttons lined up correctly. And I'm still sitting in the car and I realize, oh God, I'm covered in fur. So like I open the door, and it's like you can't lint roll yourself while you're sitting down in the car, because then it's like you can only really get like this part of you and you can't get your back and whatever. So I'm like, oh Christ. So I open the door. And the whole time I'm just, there are people walking by and staring and pointing. Other actors probably who have just come from a successful audition for the same part, giving an excoriatingly brilliant reading. And so I get out of the car and I keep the lint roller in that little thing at the bottom of the door. There's that little trough on the inside of the driver's side door where you just sort of keep change and whatever. And so in my case, I'd put the lint roller in there. So I reached down into the little storage trough and I'd bring out the lint roller, which, of course, had glued itself to a can of Viso in the bottom of which was about like an inch and a half of like warm from however long ago. And, of course, it was then a thing that turned upside down and poured itself onto my pants. So now I'm standing outside. My shirt is buttoned all wrong. I'm covered with white poodle hair. I'm trying to lint roll myself and I've just poured Viso onto my pants. And it's like you just sit there. You go like, why? I mean, when I asked you, I think yesterday after the show, I don't think it was on the air. I just said like, I almost want to ask them like, why do you keep calling me back? Like, I wonder if there's a bet or something that's been placed. There's some sort of like the wager on like how long I'll come back before I figure out that I'm being punked. Like that thing for school where like everybody's going to shave their head. It's not just going to be you. We'll see you tomorrow. So then. And this is a universal thing, maybe for guys only, but I mean, where it's I've dumped the liquid onto my pants. So then what are you doing? Then it's like you're rubbing the liquid in your pants, thinking that will magically dry it somehow. Thinking, well, at least if I can just shove the liquid into the pants, then it won't look like I've, lost control of myself. You're so excited am I to play Harvey the Millionaire. So this was the sight that greeted them as I walked into the casting offices from my big leverage. I'm here. I swear to God. And what greeted me when I walked in, and this is really sort of the end of it because it's like, where else could I possibly go with this? But I walk in and the sight that greets me, and of course, it's a casting agency, so I guess you expect this to some degree. But it's like I basically look like I've wet myself. I'm covered in dog hair. It's like the buttons on the shirt are maybe right. Maybe they're not. I don't know. I think I'm breathing heavily from just like trying to run up the stairs to make it in. So I walk inside. And of course, the waiting area is filled with nothing but like impossibly gorgeous women who are there to audition for the part of like impossibly gorgeous woman. And I just hello. And I just walk up to the desk where the woman who runs the casting desk, I swear to God, has a small little habit trail thing in front of her with little mice inside. She is crushing up Sun Chips, feeding them to the mouse and saying, here you go, my pretties. And it was like, I just like, where am I? Like,
by the
what?
Way, is that Ronyell?
No.
Oh, because I know her, by the way. I know her. So yeah. Maybe I should actually get a hold of her at some point and say, so how embarrassing really are Rick's auditions?
No.
Come on, you can tell me.
Here's the thing, though. She tells you, you got to keep it from me. you got to keep it from me, or otherwise it'll just, you know, it'll be like psyching me out on the court, you know, that I won't be able to hit the threes like I do. Because the answer, by the way, is incredibly, incredibly awkward and embarrassing, I would think. Oh, and then she just sat back and started playing the ukulele. So it was all very, like, it's a whole weird thing.
Well, it is Portland.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was, you know, so that's it. And then,
well, how did the audition itself go? I mean, when you said your lines, did you sound embittered and millionaire-ish?
I was going to say, I'll get to that in 1 second. But before I do, because having two women here, I can ask you this.
Okay.
Is there some memo that has gone out where, like, women everywhere have to wear these boots that have, like 12-inch heels or something in the back, and they're like up to their knees? I mean, there was like, yes, no lie, 6 or 7 women there, and they weren't exactly the same kind, but they were all basically just these impossibly tall, like, you know, like black leather boots things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was like, if that's a trend in fashion, or if that's a thing that actresses do to look taller.
I think it's a trend in fashion because it's like I keep seeing the boots, and I'm seeing people wear it on TV that way. Lauren Graham keeps dressing like that on Parenthood. Yeah, it's like you wear a flouncy skirt that ends like a couple inches above your knee. Then you wear the boots that come just below the knee. And you look like you should be, like, you know, singing in a bar in
that
Nashville
exactly
or something.
Exactly the look, though. They all had a variation on that theme. Yeah. And so I didn't know if it was a sort of like, you know, they were trying to differentiate themselves by looming over their, you know, the other women who were, you know, auditioning or something. They all wanted to be tall. It also distracting was like the woman who was sitting directly across from me in the waiting room looked exactly like watching Cameron from House. And so that was just like a whole thing. And, you know, I'm an awkward like boob anyway. And, you know, that doesn't help. And then I go in and it's like the thing about auditioning for like what is effectively one line is that, like, there is no ramp up to that. Like, there's no, you know, it's not like you're doing like a soliloquy or something. You know, it's like you're reading the St. Crispin's Day speech and you can really like get your momentum going and, you know, wee few. You know, and it's one line. It's like me going, hey, Bob. And he goes, hi. And I go, yeah. And then it's scene.
That was great. I bought that.
That was good.
Did you feel it? Could you sense that I was, you know.
And you said it rich. That's the important thing.
Is that a thing they say?
Say it rich.
Is that what does that mean? Oh, you mean terms of like being a millionaire?
Being a millionaire, yeah.
I didn't know if that was like actually talk.
Yeah, you know, lowering the toe that Bob, that's very millionaire.
You're weighted down by your money.
You will, by the way, be amused and not at all surprised to hear that I actually mangled the part where I said my own name into the camera too. So, you know, name, and I just said, you know, five or whatever. I don't even know what I thought I was answering. Some other question.
Emma Rickson.
And then she said, no, your name. Oh, you know, anyway. So forth. And then I said my line and I think there was only one of two, you know, it's like the jury. They say if the jury comes back in like 5 minutes, that's either really good or really bad. And so, you know, it's like, I just say my one line, they go, okay, that's great. Bye. You know, I think, well, maybe I was just so much Harvey the Embittered Millionaire that there's not even any point in having me do it again.
Oh, right.
I mean, really. I mean, it's like, why? You can't paint the Mona Lisa twice. I mean, it's like, you know, that's a cut print brilliant.
When I wrote the part of Harvey the Millionaire, I envisioned someone a little pasty and spindly with energy drink on his pants and poodle fur and buttons askew. How did he know that?
I want a man with energy drink on his pants. You're the only person on planet Earth to say that phrase today, by the way. So you are a snowflake in that regard.
It says in the script, Harvey the Millionaire, he seems like the kind of man who would have energy drink on his pants. And people are getting their sides and going, what does that mean? How do I act that? And Rick Everson's going, I know exactly how to act that.
Well, and then it's like you cut to, I mean, it's like if you were at any point just to have like a little like webcam or something watching like the people in the waiting room, you know, which would, I think, be fascinating because if you watch people who are waiting to audition, and I don't know if you've ever done like acting or drama or whatever, but Don, you've done that. And if you see people waiting to audition, and it's like there's so many different, some people are just very like silent. It's like they're just, you know, they're just in themselves and they're locked in and they don't want to talk to you because they don't want to like break like whatever the concentration they've got or an accent they've been working on or something. And like then there's always the guy who's pacing back and forth. And he's doing the accenting different words in the sentence. You know, good to see you. Good to see you. Good to see you. And then there's, you know, the person who's just primping all the time, or the woman who was looking through all of her headshots to find the one that didn't make her look too deep.
I was always the one who was just sitting there watching all the other people, because if I thought too much about what I was about to do, I would just get nervous and start to cry.
See? And there's that person. And then there's me. And it's like I'm just like brushing my hand over my pants over and over again, like I've got some sort of spastic defect. You know? Anyway. They haven't called back, by the way, just in case you were wondering about that.
Well, it was just yesterday. I mean,
they're probably letting the, you know, well, they don't, here's the thing. They don't want to crush the dreams of the others by getting back to me right away. They don't want to.
Well, they've probably got you're nailed down. They're just busy, like, figuring out which beautiful girl to cast.
It's the lead.
But you, it's like, oh, yeah. Emerson is Harvey, the inventor millionaire.
Your take on the character was so interesting and different that they have gone back to beef up the role,
yeah.
I'm sure.
They just think of that Hutton guy. He's just not, he's not going to be able to hold his own in this scene. All right. What were we going to do here?
We're going to talk about Justified.
Oh, yeah. All right. Let's. We'll do this, and then we'll get your clue number four for this week for the EH Vending Name That Snack Contest. Oh, by the way, I will say that we should just do this here at the top, that the Name That Snack Contest brought to you by EH Vending. Find out more about them by going to ehvending.com. That is the way you contact them online. You can contact them by going to ehvending.com. You can also contact them via the phone if you like. If you are in Vancouver, you can call Josh at 360-816-1853. You can also call James at 503-897-8204 in Portland. That is 503-897-8204. So if you are the owner or operator of your business, if you're the guy who calls the shots, and you decide that you know, you've just had it with like year old Twizzlers or something, and you want to freshen up the vending machine supply, or you want to get like the thing the Oregonian has, where you press the button and it's like out comes your vanilla macchiato, or you know, whatever. Get it taken care of. They have everything. They have everything from the regular coffee service to your soda machine, your snack machine, your refrigerator, and they can find a way to make it work with your budget. So if you are perhaps starting a new business, or you are just you're just finding that maybe they don't want to deal with somebody that only has one or two outlets, or you're just trying to see if you can maybe rein in costs a little bit, they will find something that works for you. You can contact them at ehvending.com or 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. That is 503-897-8204. Once again, if you are the first person to correctly identify this week's snack once the final clue is given out tomorrow, Friday, if you are the first person to correctly identify the snack by emailing snack at rickemerson.com, you will win a heaping helping of consumable goodness from EH Vending. Here is clue the fourth for this week. Today's clue is silver wrapper. That is your clue for today, silver wrapper. So tomorrow we'll give the final clue, and if you are the first person to identify it at the snack at rickemerson.com, you'll win a big fistful of stuff from EH Vending, some of which is sitting at Dawn's house right now.
Yes, and speaking of the whole dog hair, pet hair thing, it's like I actually looked around my house before I brought them in from the car. I was like, where can I put these that they're not going to be covered with dog?
Yeah.
Well, the dog would eat, also they won't get dog hair on them. And Patrick was like, I'll go get those bags out of the car. I was like, okay, but don't put them on the floor. You know, don't let them touch the floor. It's like they're actually on.
Oh, because they're those cloth bags.
Yeah, they're those cloth bags. And so they're actually on my dresser in my bedroom, because that was the largest clean space that it wouldn't get dog
hair
on.
Why not just leave them in the trunk?
I could have done that. Yeah, it's like,
Full circle is what that was. A little callback. Let's talk about last night's episode of Justified, which was great, by the way.
It always is, though.
And I mean, it really is a great show. Part of the thing about Justified is, especially with the second episode, I think in particular, I had gone back on this jag of watching a little bit of The Wire and Homicide and stuff, where there's a lot of overarching storylines, and I think I had to, after the second episode, I had to acclimate myself to the fact that to some extent, Justified is a little bit of a Monster of the Week show, in that he's got to track down some guy who skipped his bail or some guy who's won or whatever. There is also the Walton Goggins stuff that they sort of weave in, but it's much more like The Shield or Sons of Anarchy, that there are storylines only contained within that one episode in addition to the season-long story arcs. And I think once I recalibrated myself and went back and watched that second episode again, I was able to much more fully click with this season. But last night was really, really good. And again, with material that could very easily have been just so rote and so, I mean, it's like, how many cliches can they pile into one show, and yet it somehow does not feel cliched?
It's that writing that It all, of course, is based on originally an Elmore Leonard short story. And I think that it's continued to have that flavor, which Elmore Leonard, like, and I've mentioned, like Carl Heisen, like Joy Lansdale with his Happen Leonard books, things like that, getting interesting details that are attached to what could be very cliched characters.
Right.
And in this case, you know, it's the brother-in-law of Raylan's partner who... seems like he's probably an actually pretty nice guy at the beginning. Then we find out not so much, really. But he's trying. He wants to go see his kid, and he's carrying this, not just a Furby, a knockoff Chinese Furby that only a Furbot,
a Furby
that only speaks Chinese.
Yeah.
And then getting out and talking to his ne'er-do-well drug dealing buddy, who is telling him all about how, you know, his new goal is to become a magician. He wants to be a magician. He's going to be Flex.
They did also,
not
by the
Flex
way,
Flex Magnificent or anything, just Flex.
And they did avoid the, and I was bracing myself for it. They did avoid, because he was like, well, what are you going to call yourself? And he's like, Flex, not Flex Magician, Flex. And I was bracing myself for the terrible, like, Black Magic pun, which did not come again because that show is smart enough not to do that. You know.
But it led to that great scene where after everything kind of goes awry and the guy gets shot, he gets shot in the hand, comes back, comes after the brother-in-law, and is standing there with a bandaged hand and a gun in the other hand going, I was going to be a magician.
But not anymore.
How am I supposed to be a magician? I can't use my hands.
The other way that show, specifically last night, that it sort of subverted expectations, which seems to be, that is the stock and trade of a lot of the finer programs on television now, where they set things up in one way and they lead you to, it's not even a red herring as such. It's just that they resolve things in a way that is not trite and predictable. They recognize that life has facets and flavors and textures and whatever. He has that whole ongoing thing of having the Furbot or the Furby or whatever it is that speaks Chinese, which actually ended up being a sort of a very sweet storyline, a sweet and kind of sad storyline in a way that you know, because the thing is he went into the clink when he was, you know, however long ago, 4 or 5 years or something. And when he was going in, it's like all his son, who was like 7 years old at the time, wanted was a Furby. And so now he gets out and the kid is 12. And he's got, like, not just, you know, like a knockoff Furby, which is the best he could do, but his like, overriding mission, because it's his son's birthday, is to go deliver this knockoff Furby to the kid who is now 12, which is instantly just very sad because time has stopped for the guy while he's in prison. But they do that great thing at the end where the kid actually finds the Furby really interesting. A, because it speaks Chinese and it's covered in blood and it has a gun wound.
It has a bullet hole through it. And it's covered with blood, but yeah.
But the kid doesn't do the whole, like, you're not my real, you know, I don't have a father, which you've seen a million times, which happens, but, you know, it probably also happens the other way sometimes. And you just don't ever see that because it's not an easy dramatic, flourish. And so they don't ever show the more nuanced ending. And that's what we got last night.
And there's also another scene showing us just the devious brilliance of Raylan Givens. Also with the devious, brilliant acting of Timothy Oliphant. But going to see Mags Bennett.
Yeah.
To talk about the fact that this oxybus was knocked over, knowing full well that she would not approve of this.
Right.
And knowing pretty much how it's going to shake out, that he tells her that her sons had done this. And them having that very careful conversation where she, you know, pretends she has no idea what he's talking about.
But it's like everybody in the room knows what's being discussed.
Right. And everybody knows exactly why it's being discussed is because he knows that she will do something about it.
You know, and he gives the kids those like little tchotchkes from the marshal's office, and they say, justice is coming, which, you know, and she is such a great character. I mean, she is like, Cheryl actually nailed it when she said that she is like right out of the wire.
Yeah.
The kind of character that should not be believable because she's this big maternal, you know, Southern lady who makes the great iced tea and the great apple pie or whatever, but then is also like a ruthless drug dealer, which is the thing that could just seem so contrived or corny, but it's like she sells it. I mean, she really, and it's largely because they people that show with, that show is people with actors who look not even unattractive, but normal. They look like real people. You know, and Timothy Oliphant is, he's very pretty and whatnot. But it's like that show is a cross-section of humanity. There are people who are attractive, people who are unattractive, and everybody else kind of in the middle, which is how life sort of is. And that she has like a real gravitas too when she's talking, where you just sense that she has that, she has the coiled spring. you know, when she's talking, where she is the kind of a character who speaks very softly and quietly because she doesn't need, what does he say in Goodfellas? Because he doesn't need to move fast for anybody. And because you sense that if something really does become a problem, she has no issues like snuffing you out. And so she doesn't yell. She doesn't really raise her voice because she knows that, you know, if push comes to shove, she can just have you removed. She's really, she's a great character.
And then we also continue the journey where we still don't know.
Goggins.
Goggins. God, we still don't know what's going on with Boyd. Is Boyd really on the straight and narrow? Or is Boyd just playing these guys out to see what exactly it is they are going to offer him? That if the offer to do something heinous is good enough for him, is he going to take it?
Yeah, it really is just, it's a great show. So if you all...
Goggins.
Y'all... It's just not even become Walton. He's just become Goggins to me. If y'all are not watching Justified, though, you really have to do that. That is so the season, second season, episode 4 just aired last night. It airs on FX, and you can I think the first season's out on DVD right
now. Yeah, and it's probably like on Hulu or on TV somewhere or something. You can find it.
Also, Joelle Carter mentioned on Facebook how great we are that she enjoyed talking to us.
Yeah, that's right. Joelle Carter liked us.
All right. I can't believe I'm going to say this. We have to bump the top 5 to tomorrow. I just...
Okay.
Just here's the thing. I would do it, except there are people waiting in the kitchen.
Oh.
People waiting on me, as they say. And also, like, Anna's got like a family, a job, and a life.
Right.
And we're basically just kidnapping you now,
it's
like on alternate Thursdays.
Too much cheese talk is really the problem today.
I just feel like I said at the top of the show, we have to do. We can't not do the top. I got a thing I'm doing. We're doing a taping of a thing. Well, I can just say. So we, I guess, strangely enough, I have actually not mentioned this, although Sarah and Greg did. But we did last weekend. We did a shoot at Scott Daly's house, which I haven't actually put all the photos up myself. A lot of them are just sort of tagged on Facebook or whatever. But we did a shoot at Scott Daly's house for a little teaser trailer for this book that I got coming out in May, along with Lisa Desjardins. And so we shot the trailer, but there's some voiceover that goes with it. And so the voiceover, we are taping that here today because we have this the plushly appointed studio.
Yes.
And Jason Crump's gal Ashley has been kind enough to come in today, and it's like other people have like actual jobs and schedules, and so I don't want to keep everybody waiting. So that is the only reason I'm the thing is, it's a delayed payoff, but it's still for the people. They won't get it for a while, but it's still a service that Rick Emerson provides the public.
And I, I need to get home. Got to do a bunch of. I'm going to have to actually do a bunch of work this evening and be so I can come in tomorrow morning, because when we see each other next, I will have met Michael Ian Black.
I forgot all about that.
Not only Michael Ian Black is going to be on Fun Employment Radio tomorrow,
and
I told Greg and Sarah what a huge. Huge longtime fan I am of Michael Ian Black.
So that's before our show?
Yeah.
Well, it must be because they got the Blazers thing.
And they actually even invited me to even sit in on the interview.
So
it's not just, it's not going to be like Mr. Cash Cab. Oh, no. It's not going to be like Ben Bailey where, this is my friend Don. And he goes, hey. And I say, hey. And then I walk out of the room. No. It's not going to be like that. I'm going to actually get to sit in on the interview and hang out with Michael Ian Black.
During the interview, what you should do is instead of actually just sitting in as such, you should just pop up in the corner occasionally in a bubble and say something ironic. And then then go and vanish again. And then have Hal Sparks come in and do the same thing and just trade off like half an hour.
Hey, everybody needs a paycheck.
Hey, no, Rick Emerson is, brother got to eat.
But I, unlike Greg and Sarah, I can talk to him about his podcast, too, because I've been a fan of his podcast.
What's the thing that you were telling me about? They eat snacks.
Mike and Tom eat snacks. He and Tom Cavanaugh podcast when they talk about their work together and friendship as actors. And then each episode, they eat and rate a snack.
Awesome. So that is tomorrow on Fun Employment Radio, special guest, Michael Ian Black. But he's really just an adjunct. He's an appendix to you, Don Taylor.
This is going to be a real test of my ability to not act like a dorky fangirl, because I have those moments like when we had Bill Carter in, where I admire Bill Carter enormously. And he is gorgeous, and he is well-spoken, and he's great.
But
I'm not a fan as such. I'm fine. Even with Ben Bailey, it's like, hey, I'd really like to meet Ben Bailey. Yeah. That would be great. This is my first experience doing this where I'm actually going to be in the room with somebody that I am actually a fan of them. And so it'll be interesting to see if I get tongue-tied, if I do anything like insanely stupid.
That's such a sad commentary on the state of American film, because you were a film critic.
Yeah.
And yet you're like, well, this is the first time I'll be in the room with somebody who's...
Oh, well, I mean, I was nervous when I interviewed Guillermo del Toro and when I talked to Bruce Campbell.
But you weren't gushy.
But I wasn't like, oh my God, I love you.
Oh, you're the biggest thing ever. Because you're just because everybody's afraid of turning into that Chris Farley. You know, you're awesome. You know, it's you know, so all right. Well. Don't,
we'll
know,
see what happens.
Whatever you do, don't dwell on it tonight. Don't worry about it. Don't lay awake in a covered in a sheen of sweat.
And unlike with Ben Bailey, this time I will actually get to find out what he smells like.
Okay, that's
you
weird.
Should be, yeah. Awesome. We'll go out on that. We want to thank our special guest, Anna Griffin, reader and printer of The Oregonian, or online at OregonLive.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig with another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101. And tomorrow, FunEmploymentRadio.com featuring Michael Ian Black and Don Taylor. So that is coming tomorrow. After a brief musical interlude, you will be graced by an encore of today's Legion of News program, followed by an encore of this very fine radio show. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from y'all. It is Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. And that is The Frequency, Kenneth. As always, thanks for listening. Be safe. See you tomorrow. Bye now.